It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 567 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, October 7, 2018. I am the Sala Monster. I want to say thank you to everybody for all of the birthday wishes on Twitter and Facebook, all the emails I got. It was very kind of you to chime in on that. Had a good day, although I had to wake up early for Super Showdown, as I know many of you did. And I know many of the UK fans out there are probably laughing at all of our expense. Haha, we do this all the time. Now you get to feel our pain. Actually, it wasn't even as bad, I'm sure, as what a lot of the UK fans go through, probably with Raw every week. I mean, those guys are up probably, what, 2 a.m., 3 a.m. their time, 4 a.m. maybe? I didn't wake up quite that early. But yeah, it's no fun. It is no fun, but it was a good day. One of the more frustrating things I have to just say about my iPhone and the autocorrect. So it's funny, I have an aunt, and her name is Barbara. So it's Aunt Barbara, and you know, sometimes I'll text with my brother or something, and I'll mention her name. And invariably what has been happening for whatever reason is my phone is autocorrecting Barbara to Barnaby. And I have no idea why this is happening. So I'll be writing a message, and if I'm writing it really quickly, maybe I don't even realize it until it's sent sometimes. You know, if it's like a brief message. And instead of saying Aunt Barbara, it'll say Aunt Barnaby. And I laugh, and then I say to myself, I don't even know anybody by the name of Barnaby. There is nobody in my address book, first or last name, that even has that name. So I have no idea where this phone is getting this from, but apparently I have an Aunt Barnaby who I'm not aware of. So that was a little frustrating. But aside from that, it was a good day. And we have a bunch of different things to get to here. The format is a little bit different this week. I think I touched on that last week. But before I get into all of that and the shout-outs and everything else, because I know some people had asked me if I saw what happened last night at the UFC show, UFC 229. Obviously, Conor McGregor had a big fight last night that probably did a gazillion buys on pay-per-view. And so today you'll have a lot of very upset people and Dana White and a lot of very exasperated people who believe me once the final buy rate comes in. They'll have a big fat smile on their face, I'm sure. But Conor lost. He lost to this guy, Khabib, who submitted him, I guess, in the fourth round. I didn't see it live, but I saw this morning, I went back, and there were clips online of the end of the fight and what happened post-fight, so I got caught up on everything that that happened. Then, obviously, Conor lost, and this guy, Khabib, jumped the cage into the crowd, and he went to attack, I don't know if it's a teammate of Conor's, I think it was. There was a lot of taunting going on. This guy literally jumped. He hopped over the cage, over the octagon, into the crowd. This just mass melee broke out. It was complete carnage. And then they were interviewing Dana White afterwards, and he said, well, now the State Athletic Commission is going to investigate, and they're withholding this guy's purse money. It's like $2 million, I think, in purse money that now he may not be getting, or they're going to take a large chunk of it out for a big fine. And there's, you know, questions now about whether or not he'll even be allowed on a visa back into this country to compete in the future. The whole thing, you know, and everyone's saying, oh, this, you know, they do pro wrestling better than pro wrestling. Well, first of all, they do. That's just a fact. And that's been the case now for the last several years. I don't think this was worked or anything like that. In fact, I think it was incredibly stupid what happened. I mean, I don't care how personal things get in the build-up to it, and if someone's taunting you, you know, you basically just shut this guy up. You earned a big win. And then to go and sort of undo all of that by doing something stupid, he's going to have to pay the consequences for that. We'll see what those consequences are. I think, and I believe me, I have no love for Conor McGregor. He's a great self-promoter, but I think that's about the best thing I could say about him. He's a good fighter, obviously. He's a great fighter, but got his ass kicked last night. Plain and simple. But the whole thing with fights breaking out in the crowd and people getting hurt, and it's like, you know, come on. What do you expect to happen? You know what I mean? Like, and they build this whole fight up, and I know they were showing highlights of Connor back in Brooklyn. This was many months ago in April when he picked that dolly up and he threw it and broke the window on the bus that Habib was on. And that's kind of where this whole thing started. He literally picked this thing up and just chucked it through the window and didn't really have to pay much of a penalty for that, as things turned out. Didn't get thrown in jail. Really, in a lot of ways, got a slap on the wrist, given what happened there. And they were showing highlight. They were using that to build up this fight. And it's one of those things where, you know, somebody asked me, well, what do you think about that? What do you think about them, you know, doing that, building that fight up in that way? Does that condone bad behavior? Of course it does. You know what I mean? And I just, the first thing I thought of was you reap what you sow. You know, Dana White looked all frazzled on ESPN. He looked very upset. And you know, we don't know what's going to happen now. Well, you know what? You made your bed, now you have to lay in it. You reap what you sow. That's basically what it is, right? You're encouraging bad behavior, even if you may say that you're not, but, you know, actions speak louder than words, and of course that's what's going on here. So when something like this happens, it's hard to have sympathy for these people. So hopefully heads will roll, and you know, people will learn that in the future you just can't do that. You know, you can't, there's certain things that you just can't do, there's certain lines you can't step over. I watched, I can only imagine who, if you're a non-UFC fan or a casual sports fan watching this, what you must think. You can't have that. Guy fought a great fight, and then he went and undid all the good by doing something incredibly stupid, and now he's going to pay the price for it, and he deserves to. So that's my thought on that whole thing. And Connor, of course, on Twitter, oh, you know, we'll see you in the rematch. Well, we'll see. This is going to be a real test for them, because if this, again, if nothing really comes out of this and they just use this to fuel and to build a rematch, then I don't know what to say, you know? When the next time something like this happens, if somebody gets seriously hurt, innocent bystander gets hurt, well, that's on UFC and Dana White. I was also at Comic-Con a few days ago. I had told you guys I was going to be going to the New York Comic-Con over at the Javits Center. I was there and had fun. It was my first time there. I had not been to one of these before. I was struck by how many people were there. And the day that I went supposedly was the light day. That was the non-sellout, the weekday. When I say week, I mean week as in, you know, of the 4 days, the one where they were expecting, I guess, the fewest amount of people. I couldn't believe that when I heard that. I looked around. There were humanity everywhere. It got to a point I wanted to murder somebody. I couldn't move 2 feet on the show floor without bumping into somebody. Lines everywhere. I can't deal with that. I can't. It was fun. I'm glad I went. And that was enough for me. I was so frustrated. I pulled myself out of that room. I said, you know what? I got to go. I'm going to go up to the press lounge. And thankfully, it was a lot calmer up there. More space to move around. I think really in the end, what I've learned from this is that I just don't like people. Not you guys, just in general. And that's a problem because I deal with people every day. It's what I do for a living. I literally do public relations for a living. But what I've come to figure out about myself is that I don't like people. I don't like being around people. I don't like having to deal with people. I don't like having to wait in lines of people. And so that became very apparent to me as I was navigating my way through. But they had, you know, one little wrestling area. They had Sting was there, a picture of Sting. Christian was there. Trish Stratus and Lita came later on. I know Sasha Banks was supposedly there. I didn't see her. Bayley, Finn Balor. So they had some wrestling representation there. It was cool to see Sting. You know, I remarked to somebody, I said, the cool thing about Sting, Sting has the best gimmick in the world because this guy had his full costume on, his robe, he had the makeup, and he looked great. He looked like the Sting that you would see on TV 2 years ago, 5 years ago when he was still working for TNA. And obviously he's a lot older now, but when you are a wrestler who wears face paint and you wear makeup on your face, it's the best thing in the world because this guy could be 75 years old. As long as he can move around okay, put the paint on his face, you would never know. He looks like he did 5 years ago. And he was signing for just, I think it was like $80 for photos and autographs. I'm sure he made a killing. But again, overall, I feel like you should go for the experience, especially if you do like people. You'll enjoy yourself because they have all sorts of tables and they're selling all sorts of merchandise and not just comics, but artwork and Funko Pops and just everything you could think of. Everybody's dressed up as a different character. Everyone's cosplaying as someone or something. There was some guy dressed up in a bunny costume. I thought he was the Easter Bunny, but he was hanging out with these people wearing Space Jam shirts, so I assume he was supposed to be Bugs Bunny from Space Jam. Everybody is having a lot of fun there, so that's my thoughts on Comic-Con. Not much else to say about it, really. I didn't have a chance to attend any of the panels. The panels that I would have been interested in were in the days that followed. I wasn't there. In fact, they had a Boy Meets World cast reunion. I'm not ashamed to say that had I been there that day, I would have attended that panel. That's an old favorite of mine. Plus, Will Friedle, who played the older brother on Boy Meets World, he was in a movie that was made many, many years ago that had Jennifer Love Hewitt in it, called Trojan War, which is a favorite of mine. It is not a movie that a lot of people probably even know exists, but I've always loved that movie. So, little FYI there for you. I want to also mention, and this is cool, I had teased that we might be doing a Sound Off meetup the weekend before Halloween. That's the weekend of the Evolution pay-per-view. Evolution, the all-women show, is on Sunday the 28th of October at the Nassau Coliseum. It's here in New York, although it's out on Long Island. And I said, well, maybe we'll get a little Sound Off Halloween-themed meetup together. I don't know, maybe. So we're going to do it. We're having our Halloween Madness Sound Off meetup the night before Evolution, not on Long Island. We're going to do it in New York. We're going to do it in the city, Saturday night, October 27th, starting at 6 p.m., so pretty much from 6 p.m. onward. We are going to be at a little place on 3rd Avenue called Beer House, or Beer Haus, I guess is how it's... That's how it's spelled out. A lot of German beer, German food. If you're into the Oktoberfest theme, you'll love a place like this. It's spacious. In a lot of ways, it's very similar to the KBH. So if you've come out to our event SummerSlam weekend in Brooklyn at the KBH, it's a similar type of place. We'll have at least one long, you know, table reserved. Anybody who wants to eat, there's food. You can drink. You can not drink. You don't have to be 21 or over to attend. Obviously, if you're under 21, you're not going to be allowed to drink. But all ages are welcome. Costumes are not required. They're not mandated, but they are encouraged. And if we get enough people who show up dressed up as something, we may have a Halloween costume contest. So we want this to be fun. We want this to be a good time. It's the first time I'm doing, you know, a meetup like this in the area that really isn't directly connected to any particular event. So we're doing this Evolution weekend, but it's not the same night as Evolution. It's not even in the same area. So let's see what kind of turnout we get. I hope to see you there. I will put the event invite up on Facebook, and I'll link to it from my Twitter as well. So if you could RSVP to that, if you are going to be there, if you think you might be able to be there, please RSVP so that way I can get a sense of headcount. So that's going to be cool. That's coming up on the 27th of October. And don't forget, we have that new Halloween-themed t-shirt in our store on Pro Wrestling Tees. So you can buy the shirt now and get it in time for the meetup, and you can wear it maybe underneath your costume. Or if you're not wearing a costume, you could wear the shirt. Audible is still providing listeners of this show with a free book. If you sign up for a 30-day trial, all you have to do, punch in audibletrial.com/solomonster, sign up, try it out for 30 days. If you don't like it, you can cancel any time in those 30 days and keep your one free book. So that's audibletrial.com/solomonster. And thank you to everybody who made a PayPal donation this week. You can do so anytime you want on thesolomonster.com. Right-hand side of the page, you'll see the PayPal button. That is the place to go. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. Thank you to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton. Paul was in the front row Tuesday night for SmackDown Live with a giant Sound Off sign that he made. He basically recreated by hand the Sound Off logo, which I thought was super cool. And he got that sign on TV a few different times. So thank you to him. It's always cool to see the show represented like that. I think we need more Sound Off signs, frankly, at these shows. So if you bring them, because Paul let me know a few days in advance that he was going to be there, let me know. And I'll be more than happy to shout your ass off for it here on this show. So thank you to Paul for the sign and the donation. John Loose Cannon Lopez, I want to say thank you to him as well. Stephen Handyman Halistick, Thank you for your support, as always. Deadpool James Herrera, same for him. Florida Freebird Brian Becerra. Out of Control Cody Thomas. Beast Mode Brock Joseph. Yvonne Bruiser Balak. Raymond the Mountie Medina. The Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T. The Show-Off Corey Van Dam. The Chicago Screamer Ian Noel Camelotes. Brian the Cleaver Carpenter. Dan the Man Larson. Max the Axe Velado. Bernard Bam Bam Hicks, Air Raid Aaron Udell, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, The Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, West Coast Warlord Jose Luis Velasquez, or Velasquez, I'm sorry. Don't mess with the Rohan Malpure, thank you. Stacy wants to give a shout out to her boyfriend Cool Hand Luke. And if we have a meetup in New York next year over WrestleMania weekend, I hope that the two of you can make it and I see you both there. And last but not least, I want to shout out Alvaro. I want to shout out Ignacio Nacho Padilla, C-Matt, The Chad, J-King Plus, MF Martin 88, Al Cornejo, and Katie, the First Lady from Staten Island, for all of the love they left for the show in iTunes this week. I cannot thank you enough for that, so thank you very much. All right, now, I said last week that this was not going to follow the typical format. I'm going to get into some news and some random thoughts up front on a few things that I feel like talking about. And then what's going to happen is I'm going to play my Super Showdown review, which went up yesterday on YouTube, almost 70,000 views already. I'm going to include it here as well as part of episode 567 for those who did not hear it, or for those who want to just listen to it again. Of course, if you already listened to it, you can skip ahead, because after the Super Showdown review, I'll answer a bunch of mailbag questions at the very end of the show. So, you guys know, if you listened already, it's about an hour long. When we get to that point, you could always just skip ahead by an hour. By the way, we broke 40,000 subs on the YouTube channel this weekend, very quietly. I almost didn't even notice. It's already up over, I think, 40,100. So, thank you all for that. I logged in this morning just to check something, and I noticed that I said, hey, look, we broke 40K. That's pretty cool. So thank you. First off, this week's episode of the Mae Young Classic was excellent. Top to bottom, I thought it was the best hour that they've done yet this season, and everybody needs to go back and watch that main event between Mako Satomura and Mercedes Martinez. Those two went out there, and they had maybe the best women's match in WWE all year. In fact, I would probably say the best, because unlike Charlotte versus Asuka at WrestleMania, which was a very good match, this one at least had an ending that didn't make me shake my head and want to break something. So, I can't say enough good things about the match that these two had on Wednesday. Just a kick-ass match. No spoilers. I'm not getting into any spoilers here. Just go back and watch it when you're done listening to this show. And if you already saw the match, then go back and watch it again. Monday Night Raw last week broke the record they set the week before for the second lowest Nielsen number the show has ever done in its history. This tops the previous week's second lowest rating of all time. Last Monday, they were down to a 1.62 rating for the show, with the lowest third hour of the show since they went permanently to 3 hours in 2012. Just 2 million viewers for hour number three. Which was headlined by a Shawn Michaels appearance that was heavily promoted in advance, and it was promoted throughout the show. Shawn Michaels is going to be here. What's he going to do? What's he going to say? 2 million viewers. And for the people who will inevitably crow about, well, it doesn't matter, it's all about demos, or it doesn't even matter about demos, the ratings are insignificant. But people love to crow about demos. I saw there was a former WWE writer who was saying, nothing matters except demos. Just FYI, the 18 to 34 demo last week was down 15% from the week prior to that. 35 to 49 was also down, although not 15%, but it was down. The good news is that they were up in people over the age of 50. So I guess that's what happens when you headline the show with three out of the four acts north of 50 years of age. Triple H is 49, so I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. I know we're splitting hairs on this. He's not 50 just yet, so I won't lump him in there. But yeah, the lows keep getting lower. I keep saying it. WWE's favorite dance. It's the limbo. They seem to be dancing it every week. I don't have much to say about Raw itself. That segment with Elias and Kevin Owens was as much fun, I think, as I've had watching this show in a long time. Just pure, unadulterated hatred. Yeah, it's cheap heat, obviously. I mean, anybody can get booed by bashing the local sports team, or in this case, the former sports team. They were in Seattle, and he mocked them for the Supersonics leaving and going to Oklahoma City. Now, it's been years now since that happened. It's probably been like 10 years now since that happened. But believe me, sports fans do not forget. There are still people around here in these parts, here in Brooklyn, who cannot even talk. They cannot even talk, cannot even mention the Dodgers. They're still bitter about them leaving Brooklyn for LA, and they left in 1957. Now, there's fewer and fewer people like that. A lot of the old fans are dying off. But they still exist. They are still around, and they are still very, very bitter about what happened all those many years ago. So they do not let things go easily. But this was just sustained hatred that I have not seen in a long time. And honestly, I'd have to go back. Probably the last time I can remember there being a sustained hateful reaction like this, you'd have to go back to the night after WrestleMania last year. When Roman Reigns came out, this was the night after he beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania. People thought he retired The Undertaker at WrestleMania, which is funny now to look back on. Given that he's probably wrestled Undertaker has this year more times than he has in the last 2 or 3 years combined. But he came out there, and boy, did people lace into him. They didn't let him speak. I think it was like 8 straight minutes of hate until finally he just said, "This is my yard now," dropped the mic, and left. It was great. And what a missed opportunity that was, too, right? To turn him into this mega heel, which, of course, they didn't do. That's what this company is all about, missed opportunities. But yeah, you'd have to go back at least then, and before that, I don't even know. This was just hate on another level. Elias almost corpsed at one point. He was so caught off guard by it. He looked like he was having a blast. Kevin Owens was confused, because Kevin Owens, he didn't know what the hell was going on, because he legitimately knows nothing about sports. He does not care about sports. He doesn't have a favorite sports team. Zoos. Name a zoo, he can probably tell you where it is. He's big on that kind of stuff. Sports, not so much. So that was fun. The Revival losing to the B Team, that's just classic WWE. You know, the Revival was coming off their best match to date on the main roster, which was the best match of Raw the week before. People were talking about, whoa, what a great match that was against Dolph and Drew, and there were even rumors that Vince McMahon himself was supposedly impressed with the Revival coming out of that match. So what do? The very next week, they job them out to the fucking B Team. And it's not even like they won the week before. They lost that match too. But winning and losing, I mean, if you go out there and you put in the kind of performance and have the kind of match they had, it's not a big deal. I don't know that, you know, people were upset they lost. I think more people were like, wow, that was a damn good match. So the very next week, they lose, but they lose to the B Team. And I look at that and I just think to myself, I can't even get angry about it anymore. I just look and I go, who could possibly care any more about any of this? You wonder why people are indifferent. You wonder why people vote meh in polls on Twitter. This is just one example of why. Why should anybody care? How are you supposed to get behind anybody or get behind anybody as an act that you could take seriously when this is the sort of thing that constantly goes on? You know what I mean? And it's just around and around and around we go. You know, there was an Associated Press headline, AP story this week. The headline was, "The Mormon Church is scaling back the Sunday time commitment expected of its members from 3 hours to 2. And you can imagine the first thing I thought of. And I read this story and it said, you know, since 1980, church members have been expected to attend a 1 hour sacrament worship service every Sunday, followed by 2 hours of meetings such as Sunday school and other things. And under the schedule change, members will continue attending the 1 hour Sunday service, but then only one additional hour of meetings." And they have a quote from this person, it doesn't matter what his name is, but he's a member of a Mormon leadership group, and they interviewed him. And his quote was, he says, "Church leaders have been aware for years that the 3 hour block was difficult for many." You don't say. You don't say. Hey, this could be applied to a lot of different things. I look at this and I say, if the Mormon church can scale back from 3 hours to 2, surely WWE could do the same thing. But then they would lose out on millions of dollars, so we're stuck with 3 hours for the foreseeable future. But I saw that and I laughed. I was just like, oh, I gotta mention this. I have to mention this at some point during the show this week. 3 hours, too difficult for many people, you don't say. Brie Bella and Daniel Bryan, I wrote their names down here because I wanted to talk about this as a follow-up to the big controversy from the previous week. Everybody was talking about the injury to Liv Morgan and Brie Bella kicking her not once but twice in the face. A lot of you pointed out that I even forgot in the heat of my rant to mention something else that I had wanted to mention, which was what happened with Brie and Ruby Riott a little bit later on in that same match. Anyway, Liv Morgan has been cleared to compete after the concussion that she suffered at the feet of Brie Bella. That was obvious. She was at Super Showdown. Before she was cleared, though, Brie Bella put a statement out on Instagram addressing all of the hate that she got after kicking Liv in the face and knocking her silly. She talked about the love and the joy of being a mom, and she followed it up by saying, and I quote, "Happy people don't waste their time or energy being cyber bullies. Miserable people do. If you aren't living the life you wish, I pray that you find what makes your heart happy and stop wasting energy on promoting hate. For the happy people, silence hate. Don't let it bring you down." Now, her husband, Daniel Bryan, was so upset about all of the hate that his wife was getting that he too felt the need to say something about it. This is what he had to say. He said, "I am proud of how strong my wife is after accidentally injuring Liv Morgan. The first time Brie has ever hurt another performer, she has been subject to a constant barrage of social media attacks. Almost every wrestler has accidentally hurt someone, but rarely do you see the kind of hate when it happens. For example, I could cuss Randy Orton in 2012 after hitting him with what was supposed to be a chair to the back. Unfortunately, part of the side hit him in the back of the head, and he was forced to miss a pay-per-view. In 2009, in our last match against each other, I concussed Nigel McGuinness after doing a dive onto him from or into the crowd where his head hit the floor. And there are others. As for the yes kicks 2 weeks ago, I accidentally kicked Andrade directly in the head due to a miscommunication on my part. I feel fortunate that he was okay because there are few feelings worse than hurting someone. Despite all of that, never did I receive the backlash that Brie did this week. With all of the negative things said about my wife, nobody was harder on her than herself. Thank you to the many people who reached out to support her, both publicly and privately. Well, we all wish Liv Morgan a speedy recovery." And he ends with the hashtag #EndCyberBullying. So they settled on cyberbullying as the narrative here. Cyberbullying as the narrative, and Brie is the victim. And okay. Now, there were people who tweeted her some really vile things, and so I sure hope that she's only referring to those people when she says this, and not all of the people who simply criticized her for being reckless. Because to turn around and claim that you're being cyberbullied because a bunch of people criticized the fact that you kicked this woman in the face, not once, but twice, I find that to be quite rich. Now, Brian, I mean, look, he's defending his wife. I would expect him to do nothing less. I'm surprised it took him that long to put a statement out. But I stand by what I said a few... I can't speak for other people. I don't know what other fans and podcasters and people are saying. I don't give a shit. I can only speak for myself. I stand by what I said a few weeks ago when it first happened, which is that if she feels that she needs time, and she has said this in interviews, if she feels that she needs time to get her body acclimated from childbirth now to being back in the ring because she had missed so much time, she had been out of the ring and retired for so long, then she needs to fly down to the performance center and work off whatever ring rust she has. Because she didn't, you know, kick Liv in the face 2 times in that match and that was it. She gave Ruby Riott a pretty good elbow, pretty good shot to the face in that same match. Ruby did not look to appreciate that very much. And before that, she almost killed herself diving a few weeks before out of the ring. But apparently now criticizing wrestlers makes you a cyberbully. I just think that this is madness. I feel like I'm in the movie 300 now. This is madness. It is. It really is. But please, don't tweet death threats to wrestlers. Supposedly there were death threats that she got. That is just over the top on a whole other level. Don't do that. Don't tweet vile, creepy shit to them. Because then you make all the rest of us look like a bunch of knuckle-dragging idiots. Because we all get lumped in together. Criticizing her, though, for what happened in the ring is fair game. And that is not cyberbullying. And to say that that's what this is an insult to kids who have actually been cyberbullied. Just work through whatever it is that you think you need to work through so that you don't hurt yourself or somebody else. It's very simple. Neville is back. The Red Arrow has landed in Dragon Gate. Yes, he has resurfaced after going dark for a while. Since leaving WWE last year, he has stayed away. There was some debate about whether or not he was still bound by his non-compete from his WWE contract. There were people speculating he might end up in New Japan or Ring of Honor, maybe Impact. Will Ospreay has apparently been lobbying to convince Neville to come to New Japan so they could work a match at Wrestle Kingdom. Instead, he resurfaced under his old name of Pac in his old stomping grounds of Dragon Gate in Japan, which is really a promotion that is focused on the lightweights and the cruiserweights. And Neville was, of course, the king of the cruiserweights in WWE, so I guess it really shouldn't be all that surprising. It is, though, because unless he's got some sort of special deal that allows him to work elsewhere, that would seem to mean no New Japan. You know, now obviously he has a soft spot in his heart for Dragon Gate. He spent many, many years there before coming to WWE. He supposedly really loves working there. So look, you know, go where you're going to be happy, but this guy could clean up very nicely anywhere he chooses to go. Now, he may not have that same buzz in a year. Right now, though, because he's been away for so long and there's been some sort of almost mysticism about him and where is he and is he going to wrestle again and where is he going to land? If anything surprises me is that he didn't, or at least not yet, hasn't fully taken advantage of that. It would just seem to me that he had grown to a point where now going back to Dragon Gate, he's sort of a big fish. I mean, he's a small guy, but a big fish in a small pond, even though he may be really happy there. But he, you know, he made a surprise return. He was the mystery partner in a six-man tag on a Dragon Gate show. And look, my guess is that he ends up in a much bigger promotion, I would think, inside of 6 months, whether he stays with Dragon Gate or not. He's just too good to be cooped up there for too long. And if New Japan or Ring of Honor don't grab him, I mean, hell, maybe MLW can. If one of those promotions doesn't grab this guy, assuming he's even interested in coming back to the States, then they're doing something wrong. And I have to think they all tried, that they all made inquiries into it. Maybe they were turned down. Maybe they just didn't hear anything back. I would still make a play for him if I were running a promotion. Even though I see he's back there in Dragon Gate, I would make a play for him. I would see if, you know, he's willing to come on in and work for me. So hopefully we get to see him. I, you know, just think that now is the time. You know, you can't wait too long because in 6 months or a year, you know, you may not be able to get the kind of deal that you could probably get now. And there's still some buzz around him. So we'll see. We'll see in a few months if he ends up somewhere else or just sticks to Dragon Gate for the foreseeable future. The Undertaker gave a rare sit-down interview with Pastor Ed Young. He is the senior pastor at the Fellowship Church in Texas. Undertaker, of course, lives in Texas. I cannot begin to tell you how many tweets and how many Facebook posts and emails that I received with links to this interview. Don't know if you saw it. Here's the link. Have you seen this? Can you talk about this? I don't know if you've seen this. Here's the link. I wanted to cry. They just wouldn't stop. So obviously this thing got around. It's got over 1 million views now on YouTube. I doubt, you know, many of the other similar types of videos that Pastor Ed Young has done, has gotten 1 million views. But this, I looked at this and I thought to myself, this should have been the interview that he did with Stone Cold for his podcast on the network. Many moons ago, they put a press release out. Steve Austin's going to be interviewing Sting and The Undertaker. I mean, unless I just completely dreamt it, I could have sworn this was actually announced at one point, and then it just never happened. And in fact, we haven't seen a Stone Cold podcast on the network probably since Dean Ambrose. Dean Ambrose ruined the whole thing. That interview was so bad, they haven't done one since. Unless I'm just forgetting one. It certainly was one of the last ones Austin did on the network, if not the last one. But yeah, I just watched it. I thought, man, this would have been super cool if it was actually Stone Cold doing the interview and they had the full hour on the network to just sit and shoot the shit with The Undertaker. They could talk about their own matches and their own feud and the Attitude Era. and a bunch of other things. So I thought it was a missed opportunity, but it was still cool. We don't get to see Undertaker very often in this type of environment. The last time I could remember him sitting down for a shoot type of, you know, I say shoot, like out of character interview, is the one he did in 2002 before WrestleMania 18. They were up in Canada and he was in the arena. They were filming an episode of the Michael Landsberg Off the Record show. And you can still find it on YouTube. And again, that was probably only 20 minutes, half an hour maybe, which is about the length of what this was. This was about half an hour. But you got to think that Undertaker has so many stories and just so many tales to tell. You could get hours out of this guy. And I'll say this, you know, Ed Young, I don't know of him. He may be a good pastor. He's a pretty bad interviewer. A few times he cut the Undertaker off in the middle of a sentence. Undertaker himself, honestly, the first 10 minutes of this really weren't that good. He rambled a lot at the beginning. But it's so rare to see him do this sort of thing that it's worth tolerating those first 10 minutes just to get to the good stuff. Now, a lot of it was stories that I've heard before, like, you know, him getting that first phone call from Vince McMahon. Are you my Undertaker? I'm your Undertaker. We've heard that story before. How that has never been reenacted as a beer commercial with those two, I'll never know. But he talked about a few other things I had not heard before. So he talked about Andre the Giant and the match that never was. Because they, I think Ed Young asked him, did you ever wrestle Andre? And that triggered a story that he remembered, which is that Andre had taken a liking to him. And once said to him, you know, you and me, boss, I've got an idea. For, I guess, you know, for what they would do together in a program or in a match. But he never told Undertaker what the idea was. He tried to get it out of him. Andre just wouldn't tell him. But he said, I got an idea for us, boss. So he tried to get the answer Undertaker did out of Tim White. Tim White was good friends with Andre. I think he was kind of his handler in many ways. And, you know, former WWF referee. And Tim White didn't know. So he didn't know what Andre had in mind. Andre didn't tell anybody what his idea was. And The Undertaker, to this very day, still wonders what the idea was that Andre had for. Now, Andre passed away before it could happen. It wasn't happening anyway, because by that point, his health was so bad. I mean, Andre's health was in such decline that there's no way that that would have ever happened anyway. But Taker and Andre is one of those fantasy matchups that, you know, when I was younger and I would read all the old WWF magazines, they constantly would have, like, fantasy warfare matchups. And that was one that would come up from time to time. Andre and Undertaker, what would happen, you know, if the two of them had a match? To me, the real dream match with those two would have been Andre, young Andre, from the 70s, the Andre who moved around like a lightweight sometimes. Andre back then was so agile. I mean, I was on YouTube one day and I fell down the rabbit hole. This was around the time that the Andre documentary hit HBO. So I was on YouTube and I was watching a bunch of Andre the Giant clips and some Andre the Giant match highlights, and I stumbled on a lot of his old stuff from the 70s, and I was just mesmerized watching this, because you forget. I mean, when I grew up, Andre was already past his prime. He wasn't as bad as he got in the late 80s, but he was already on a downward trajectory at that point physically. And unless you grew up in the 60s and the 70s and went to the old Madison Square Garden shows in the 70s when Bruno was still active and, you know, Bob Backlund and Billy Graham and Pedro Morales and guys like that, you don't know or you forget how good of a big man Andre really was, how quick he could be, how light on his feet he could be, the moves that he would do. There was one video I came across that Andre, now I don't remember if he was giving it or taking it. But there was a video of Andre, I think he might have been giving somebody, a version of a Canadian destroyer. I mean, the things that he was doing back then was unbelievable. So what I would have loved to have seen was that version of Andre against, like, the mid to late 2000s version of The Undertaker. The Undertaker who was cranking out better matches than he did when he was 10 years younger. That would have been a hell of a match. You talk about a fantasy matchup, that would have been a fantasy matchup. So he talked about that. He talked about his injuries. He's had both eye sockets crushed. I knew of one. I know he had his orbital bone, I think it was fractured or shattered by Mabel. Mabel gave him a leg drop in 95. I think it was on an episode of Raw. and it crushed his orbital bone. That's why he had to wear that Phantom of the Opera type mask for a few months into the beginning of 96. So I knew about that. I didn't know that he had the other one crushed. He said he's had about 20 different orthopedic type surgeries throughout his career. He confirmed that both hips have now had some form of a hip replacement. It sounded like not a full-on hip replacement. That may come when he's actually retired, which will never happen. But he's had some form of a hip replacement already done. Probably why he's been moving around a little bit better this year than he was when we saw him last year. I mean, there was a noticeable difference when he came back for the match with Cena at WrestleMania this year compared to the way he was moving for the match with Roman Reigns last year. He talked about torn biceps, torn triceps, torn pecs. He was getting into some other injuries when the interviewer cut him off, one of the many times he got cut off during this interview. But the thing that got the most play were his comments about the younger wrestlers and the advice that he gives them. So this is what The Undertaker said. He said, "I am a firm believer in less is more, especially with my character. And when I talk to young guys, they think, okay, well, I can do." And athletes today, he says, they're off the chart. They're just ridiculous how athletically gifted the men and women are, for that matter. But they rely, he said, see, wrestling and sports entertainment is not about the moves. It really isn't. It's about being able to evoke emotion in one facet or another. You have to either make people love you or you have to make them hate you. Either way, and it doesn't matter really which one, but you have to make them feel something. Certainly people like to be hated and certain people like to be loved. But if you cannot bring that emotion out of your audience, you're not going to have them for very long. And a lot of times what happens with the young guys is they're so athletic, they're so gifted, they'll do some kind of double crazy backflip off the top rope, land on somebody on the floor, and that's what the audience takes away from it. This guy does crazy stuff. Well, you can only see that so many times before you say, well, I've seen that, I need something new. And he said that that's a double backflip, full gainer onto somebody. How do I up that? And that's the position they sometimes back themselves into. It's like they have to keep upping the ante. And when you up the ante like that, then you increase your potential for injuries and catastrophic injuries at that. So he continued on just a little bit more here. He said, characters like The Rock and Cena and Ric Flair, all those guys like that, they had the ability to make you love them or make you hate them. And Cena is such an anomaly because you don't know one night to the next whether they're going to go ballistically crazy for him or they're going to boo him out of the building. He's probably the most polarizing guy that's come along in a long time. His fan base is crazy. But what happens is he sells tickets. He works in front of full arenas. Same thing with Rock when he was here. But that's the key. We tell stories, we use moves, the wrestling moves help tell the story, but it boils down to character and being able to bring that emotion out of your audience. There's a lot of guys, it takes a while to figure that part out, and by the time they do, they're so beat up and injured and hurt that their career is basically over at that point. So the gist of what he's saying is wrestling isn't really about the wrestling, it's not about the moves, it's not about the holds. It's about the character, it's about the stories, and in that, he is 100% absolutely right. He is 100% right. The other thing he's right about, he made another comment. He said about the current guys that he sees, the younger guys, he says they're trying to emulate or be like a wrestler they watched on TV, instead of being the wrestler that is on TV. And I think that's another great point that he made. Now, not everybody does that. I don't think we should be painting all of the current guys with that brush, but are there guys who will watch The Rock or will watch Roddy Piper and will sometimes blatantly lift things from them? Of course that happens. But there's also nothing wrong with watching, and I think, I mean, I would have to think that most of the older guard would encourage the younger guys to study tapes and to watch the older stars like Ric Flair, like Roddy Piper, and study what worked and what didn't, what made them so special, and then take from that and borrow from that. Maybe not blatantly. You don't have to use the exact lines they used in promos. But I would think that they would encourage people to go back and study what worked for those guys, what made those guys so, you know, legendary and just what made them such big stars, and just try to weave that into what they do. But he's right. You've got to, you know, people will email me a lot and they'll say, who do you think is the next Stone Cold? Who's the next Hogan? How come WWE hasn't created the next Hogan? Who's the next Rock? And I always say, like, you know, if I was a young guy on the WWE roster or the NXT roster and I'm the big up-and-comer and everybody's talking and buzzing about me and they're saying, hey, you know, this guy, they said that about Dean Ambrose. When Dean Ambrose got hot for a period there a couple years ago, they said, he's going to be the next Stone Cold. And then ironically, he did the Stone Cold podcast and it seemed like it was all downhill from there. But it's so unfair to them because how can you possibly fill those shoes? It's like if you're the son or the daughter of this legendary wrestler, Charlotte is going to do, she's already doing well, and Charlotte is going to go on and do very well for herself. So she's one of the examples of somebody who I think will be fine, but you can point to a lot of, you know, third generation sons of wrestlers who have tried to make a name for themselves, and they may be very gifted and they may be very talented as a wrestler, but they're immediately handicapped because, oh, you're the son of so-and-so. Dustin Rhodes, oh, you're the son of the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. David Flair, oh, he's Ric Flair's son, right? Greg Gagne, he's the son of Vern Gagne. And, I mean, on and on, and there's tons of others that you can point to. You know, Eric Watts, right? So it's tough. If you're in that position, it's tough because you're immediately being compared to somebody who's so great that maybe physically you're more gifted than they were, but there's no way that you can match their status. All you can do is just try to blaze your own path and immediately you're handicapped. So I get emails like that and I feel badly for them. You know, or they'll say, who's the next Stone Cold? I say, they don't need to worry about being the next Stone Cold. Let us make the comparisons if we see there's some sort of similarity there. People have been joking Stone Cold Becky Lynch. But it's not like Becky Lynch is going out there flipping people off and like trying to mimic Stone Cold. She's doing her own thing and it's working for her. But to say, oh, so-and-so is going to be the next Undertaker, you know, you can't do that. He's right. You have to not worry about being the next so-and-so or let me be like this guy. Be your own guy. Find something that works for you and you know, create your own legacy. It's part of the reason, maybe, why we don't have very many stars now who feel as big as the stars of 20 years ago. I mean, when Undertaker came along in the 90s, were there people comparing him to somebody else? I don't remember those comparisons. He became the Undertaker. There's only one Undertaker. Stone Cold came along. Were there people comparing him to any one particular person? No. Not that I can remember. He became Stone Cold Steve Austin. He may have borrowed the beer drinking and, you know, stuff from the Sandman, but he created his own character. There was nobody saying, oh, he's trying to be this guy. So I think Undertaker was making total sense here in this interview. I don't think he was knocking the guys who do a lot of the crazy moves, you know, that you may see in the cruiserweight matches or in some New Japan matches or Ring of Honor matches. He's simply saying that that's not really what wrestling is all about. If you believe that wrestling is about storytelling, then the moves are just there to enhance the story. The story and the character are the most important thing. Think back to some of the greatest angles and storylines in WWE history, if you're a WWE fan, right? The Mega Powers, Macho Man and Hulk Hogan. It wasn't about moves. It wasn't about matches. They told over the period of over a year, really, this great story. It's still to this day one of the all-time great, if not the best storyline I think they ever did. Austin versus McMahon, was it about the matches? Was it about the moves? It didn't have to be. I mean, the stunner was over like crazy, but it wasn't about that. It was about the story of the evil boss trying to fuck with the top babyface. And the top babyface just so happened to be the everyman that people could relate to. He drinks beer, he cusses, he's just like me. And they told this great story of Vince at every step trying to take the title from him, trying to screw him every which way. You know, these are simple, basic stories here. The Undertaker and Kane story. So he's right. I don't really see anything wrong at all in what Undertaker said in this interview. I thought it was sage advice. And I'd like to hear more from him because he's a guy that's been around forever. He's seen it all. He's worked with everybody. He's reinvented his own character a bunch of different times, from the dead man to the badass, back to the dead man, you know, the ministry taker who spoke in tongues, whatever this current version of The Undertaker is. He was talking smack to Shawn Michaels the other day, pointing his finger in his face. So I would like to hear him, you know, speak more openly about these types of things. I don't need to see him on Twitter or anything like that. He's already got an Instagram. That's enough. His Instagram is a trip, by the way, some of the pictures that he posts. But I thought it was, for what it was, I thought it was a great interview. I thought that there was a lot to unpack there. But I saw a lot of debate about whether or not, you know, do you agree with what he said? And is Undertaker, you know, bashing the current generation? He spoke the truth. There was nothing in what he said that was untrue. Kevin Nash, he was also in the news. He had some comments of his own. Now, Kevin Nash did an interview with the Sporting News to talk about this NWO reunion that he's doing with Hulk Hogan and Scott Hall. But he was also asked about The Undertaker and Triple H having a match at Super Showdown. And how, you know, how come we're not seeing Undertaker in there against a younger guy? Or how come we're not seeing Triple H in there against a younger guy to give them, you know, the big rub from doing a show like this? And this is what Kevin Nash had to say. He said, nobody cares about the younger guys. When I watched SummerSlam, that Undertaker and Triple H video package caught my eye and made me want to see that match. I don't know if I want to see Roman Reigns against The Undertaker again. What more of a rub can you give than that? He's been given rubs before, and they just aren't getting over. So then he was asked, well, why aren't the younger guys getting over? You know, to get fans to want to see more matches like that. And Nash said, well, who do you want to put in those positions? You going to put Finn Balor in there against The Undertaker? Seth Rollins? Who are you going to put? And they asked him, they said, well, then who do you blame for that? Is it the talent's fault? Is it the front office? Is it a combination of both? He said, I just don't think that there's going to be guys like that anymore. Those guys aren't going to have 30 years in the business. This style will not allow those guys to have 30 years. Seth Rollins already had a couple of knee operations, but he's a great worker. I just don't see these guys even lasting 20 years. Because of their bodies and the concussion syndrome, now WWE is doing concussion testing and everything else. So that's what Kevin Nash had to say. And he is not totally wrong. Undertaker, I didn't have any issue with the comments that he made that I just talked about. Nash, it's a little bit different. I don't think that he is completely wrong. I think his reasoning is flawed. He's basically saying, he's laying a lot of it here, it sounds to me like, on injuries. And guys that do crazy, insane, dangerous moves, they're not going to last very long in this business. And so that's why nobody is getting over and nobody is going to last. And I don't buy that reasoning. Yes, there are guys that will do crazy flippy shit who will probably not last very long in the wrestling business. There are always going to be people like that. There were people like that in the 80s. There were people like that in the 90s. And there will always be people like that. But his reasoning is flawed. It's not about injuries. It has more to do with the way that the company, and he's talking about WWE, so we'll keep this limited to WWE. It has more to do with the way the company books its talent and the talent that they choose to get behind and the talent that they choose to push. I'll use the Revival as an example. It's a small one, but I can use them as an example. I just got done talking about what they did with the Revival on Raw last Monday. They're coming off the best match they've ever had since they got called up to the main roster. The best match they've had since those classics they had in NXT. Even though they lost, they had a great showing, and everybody was impressed. And what do? The next week on TV, they job them out to the B team. Now, that's just one week. Maybe they'll be on television tomorrow night, and they'll beat the B team. What does it mean if they turn around and they beat the B team? They're called the fucking B team. For a reason. They're not meant to be taken seriously. So you job them out? Clean in the middle of the ring? And you ask yourself, why are these guys not getting over? Think about all the guys who got over and became popular when you were a younger wrestling fan. I'm not even saying super young 70s or 80s. Go back to the 90s. Go back to the mid-90s. Go back to the late 90s when wrestling was hot and everybody was into it. Even the people who didn't like wrestling. Even if they said they didn't watch wrestling, they're full of shit. Everybody watched wrestling. I knew people who didn't like wrestling who secretly watched wrestling. Hey, did you see the NWO, what they did on TV? I'm like, what do you care? You're not a wrestling fan. Believe me, that a lot of that was going on back then. Let's go back to that period. Think of all the guys who became popular in WCW. Look at the way they booked Goldberg. Look at the way they booked DDP. Look at the way they booked Sting. Look at how strong the NWO was kept. Now, that went on a little too long, and it ended up biting them on the ass because they didn't have any, hardly any baby faces outside the very top ones who anybody cared about because everybody got beat down every week. But they knew how to push a certain act if they really wanted to get them over. In WWE, Austin became a star. Triple H became a star. Has Mick Foley, I think a lot of that can be owed to Mick Foley and the way Foley put him over. Rock became a star. Undertaker became an even bigger star. Even the mid-card acts, the New Age Outlaws, they were massive stars during that period. The Godfather became a star. Al Snow and his fucking mannequin head became a star. Bob Holly became a star. He's the super heavyweight, him and Crash. I mean, there were so many hot acts at that time. And, you know, part of that was that they benefited because wrestling in general was so hot and it sort of trickled down a little bit. But you ask yourself, why? You cannot tell me that the B team pinning the Revival existed for any reason other than when AOP came out immediately after, they just wanted to have a team out there for AOP to run right through on their way to the ring. That probably was the logic behind doing what they did. That was the only way you could do that, really. You couldn't have the Revival beat them and leave. And then as the B team are licking their wounds, out comes AOP and they just run them right over. Nash says that Roman Reigns beat Undertaker at WrestleMania. He's gotten the rub from a lot of people and it just doesn't seem to matter. He's not wrong on that one. Roman Reigns has beaten Triple H and The Undertaker in back-to-back WrestleMania main events. He beat John Cena at No Mercy last year. Cena raised his arm and gave him the big endorsement. And then he beat Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam this year. He slayed the beast, finally. It took him a few times, but he finally did it. Think of all of the big names that they have put over this guy, that this guy has just dominated and beaten. All the names I just mentioned. So now he's the Universal Champion. Does he feel like a bigger star now than he did 6 months ago? Be honest when you answer that question. And if you think he is, I want to hear why. Does he feel like a much bigger deal having beaten all of those guys that I just mentioned? Was it worth it for him to beat all of those guys that I just mentioned? Looking back on it now, ask yourself that question. And he's their top guy. They're all in on him. They have all their eggs in the Roman Reigns basket. If he can't get over the way they want him to, what makes you think that anybody else on this roster stands a chance? There are guys that will just catch fire organically that they're not necessarily pushing hard. What makes you think that they're going to suddenly see this and go, oh, well, the fans are, they seem to take a liking to this person. Why don't we push this guy instead? They've had plenty of chances to do that. They had someone like that in Braun Strowman, and they said, eh, let's turn him heel. We need a good, solid heel to feud with our babyface champion. Let's turn Braun Strowman heel. And you ask yourself, why? You ask yourself, why Kevin, a guy like Kevin, and say what you want about Kevin Nash and his matches and his, but here's a guy who's been around for a time, who's looking at this, and so he's saying some of the same things that you and I are saying. He's not wrong when he says nobody cares about the younger guys. He's not too far off when he makes comments like that. So Roman Reigns is one example of a guy who goes out there and he beats all these guys, and he still doesn't feel like half as big of a deal as the old guys that they trot out for these network specials. And it goes to a bigger problem that they have, that I talked about this at the end of my Super Showdown review, which I'm going to play for you here in a second. But, you know, after I got done talking about Undertaker and Triple H and how, you know, on some level, I enjoyed the match. I knew going in kind of what to expect. I wasn't expecting an all-time classic, and it was the weakest of the matches that they've had. I enjoyed it for what it was, but what struck me in watching it, and Shawn Michaels bouncing around, and Kane is out there, and they go off the air with this, I look at that and I go, for as strong as the company may be right now, the foundation they've built, yes, the stock price, and yes, they're making millions and billions off these TV deals, that's all well and good. At the end of the day, you're a content provider, and you are providing content for millions of people every single week, And yes, they cater to a lot of different audiences. They cater to casuals, and they cater to kids, and they cater to people like you and me, and people over 50. That's all true. But one thing that they're going to have to be very cautious of going forward is that when they have special shows like this, if they feel that they have to have the old guard come back and they have to build an entire show like this around Undertaker and Triple H, it wasn't just the match. They spent weeks of their television building around this as clearly the main event of that show. Raw many weeks went off the air with some kind of segment or interaction involving Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker and Triple H, and everything else and everyone else just felt like they were taking a back seat, including Roman Reigns and Braun Strowman and the supposed big top stars on Monday Night Raw. Everybody felt like they just felt inferior. They felt less than when it came to this other stuff with the legends that was going on. People, you know, in some cases, I don't doubt, were only tuning in to see what was going to happen with The Undertaker and Shawn Michaels, and then if it was in the middle of the show, they probably immediately tuned out. And that problem is not going to go away. But I said this in my Super Showdown review, where you got to be careful about building events and building main events and building things around the old guys. There's a place for them. I don't want to see them just vanish and go away, but you know, you have to strategically use them in a way that hopefully in the end will help enhance the current roster and will help rub off a little bit on at least some key younger guys that you have targeted and said, okay, these are the four or five people or whatever it is that we want to build around or that we think could really get to a level where they could be, you know, the future top stars like Triple H and Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker were for us, you know, way back when. You know, you can't just build these shows around the old guys and try to pop a number or try to pop a rating and then wonder, well, how come the fans aren't really getting behind the younger guys? How come they're not getting behind Roman Reigns and they're not getting, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but you know what I mean? Like, I'm speaking as a fan now. I look at these two very distinctly different groups of stars, the stars of then and the stars of now. And I like the stars from the current roster that I like. But if you were to say to me, which one of the full-time, we're not even going to count Brock Lesnar because he would be the closest thing, but he ain't full-time. I don't know what deal he is. If he's coming back for one match, that may be it. But I look at the current roster full-time, Raw and SmackDown, and if you said to me, as somebody who's been watching the product for as long as you've been watching it for, who stands out to you as being the closest thing to one of these guys, or just who stands out to you as being truly special, somebody that you would stop what you're doing to make sure that you watch their segment, or you tune into what they're doing. For me, the closest thing to that of late would probably be Becky Lynch, but, you know, I mean, putting that on the side here, looking at the male talent at least, I don't have an answer for you. I like AJ Styles, but he doesn't come off to me that way. I like Samoa Joe. He doesn't come off to me that way either. Roman Reigns doesn't come off that way to me. Braun Strowman, maybe he could have had they kind of gone in a different way with him, but he doesn't. Seth Rollins doesn't. Dean Ambrose doesn't. None of them do. And these are guys in some cases that have been on the roster now for a number of years. You know, Dolph Ziggler's been featured in the main event scene on Raw now the past few months, and I mean, he's been in this company over a decade now. How many start and stop pushes did he get? Do you really want me to go on a rant about his career in this company? Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that Dolph would have been the next Shawn Michaels, but he had a lot of people behind him. Dolph had a lot of supporters. He had a lot of fans, and they fucked him, and they fucked him, and they fucked him. Constantly. To the point where he visually looked like he did not care. There are guys that have been around for a while now, and, you know, they're still stuck at that same level that they were at before. That's going to be a problem, is all I'm saying. And Nash is not too far off in the comments. I think his reasoning is flawed, but he is not far off in his comments. And there may be people who don't like hearing that. Tough shit. The truth hurts. And that is the truth. You don't have to like it, but I think the quicker that the company recognizes that, maybe they don't want to, maybe they hear people like Kevin Nash and they think, oh, he's just a bitter guy. You know, he's a bit of guy. Maybe that's what they think. Maybe they're just going to turn a blind eye to it. Well, as long as they continue to do that, nothing's going to change. So on that note, let me get into the Super Showdown review here. There was a big show from the Melbourne Cricket Ground down under in Australia, 60,000 people at the event, headlined by Undertaker taking on Triple H in their last time ever, but not really match in the main event. I will, on the flip side of this review, which is about an hour long, so if you already heard it and you want to skip ahead, that's about how long it's going to be. We'll get into your mailbag questions, all your Q&A on the flip side of this review. If you didn't hear it, though, especially the last little leg, the last 5 or 10 minutes of the review, definitely check that out. It's just a lot of what I just talked about, but I think it's an important point to make, and I don't think I'm the only one who feels that way. But anyway, on the flip side of this review, we'll get to your Q&A, and we'll finish out the show. This is Sound Off 567. This is your Sound Off Extra review for WWE Super Showdown from the Melbourne Cricket Ground in Melbourne, Australia. I am the Solemn Monster. First time WWE has had a stadium show in Australia since its Global Warning event back in 2002. That was 16 years ago. They just added that show to the network for those of you who have never seen it before. I don't know offhand what section it's in, but it is on the network now. You can go back and check it out. That show had a main event of Brock Lesnar, The Rock, and Triple H for the Undisputed title. And here on this show, we had a main event including Triple H. Some things never change. I woke up at 6 a.m. on my birthday here to watch this show so that I could get this review up as quickly as possible. And I wish I would have slept in. This was, I think, the best way to describe this show. It was a glorified house show. I see a lot of people saying the same thing because I put a poll up on Twitter and just took a very quick look at what some people were saying on my timeline. And I would agree. Glorified house show. I think that if you went into this show with very low expectations or expecting that it was going to be a glorified house show, then this show pretty much met your expectations. Maybe it even exceeded it a little bit if you were really into the main event with the stars and everything. If you went into the show expecting some kind of blow away, hey, it's a big pay-per-view, it's, you know, WrestleMania style, big stadium, they're going to do something big, then I think you were left disappointed. And judging by the early results of the poll, although thumbs up is winning out over thumbs down, the large majority of you so far have voted meh. I think over 50% so far have voted meh on this show. I think that's probably a good word to describe it. So let's get into it here. We'll just go through the results from the beginning. What was supposed to be a 5-hour show, I believe ended up being 4 hours. So the schedule definitely listed 5 hours originally. I was not at all opposed to shaving an hour off this thing. I generally think these shows are longer than they need to be. But it opened with the New Day defending the SmackDown Tag Team titles against Sheamus and Cesaro. I thought this was a good little match, nothing more. It was Kofi and Woods in there representing New Day. Bro kick attempt by Sheamus was foiled. Cesaro tagged in, and he rocked Xavier Woods with an uppercut. Gave him the swing into the sharpshooter. That got broken up by Kofi. Kofi hit the Trouble in Paradise to Sheamus on the outside, tagged in. And they won with a neat finish where Woods hit a backstabber to Cesaro, held him in place on his knees for Kofi to come off the top rope with a double foot stomp. New Day retain. I thought this was fine as an opener for what it was. Would have been cool, I think, to open the show with a hot cruiserweight title match and the big title change that came later in the show. But, you know, this was fine for what it was. It never rose to the level of even some of those really good tag team matches we've gotten on SmackDown TV in the last few months. This was okay. We have Becky Lynch and Charlotte for the SmackDown Women's Championship. Lots of love for Becky Down Under, less so for Charlotte. If this show was in Toronto, or if this show was in Montreal, we would hear nothing but nonstop bizarro world references from the announcers. I didn't pick up on one here on this show. I guess here in Australia it's okay because it's not Canada. Charlotte went for her moonsault, which the best way I can describe it would be beautiful in terms of flight. When I watched Charlotte hit this moonsault in her matches in general, not just this one. Beautiful flight, turbulent landing. Always. Always. Almost every single time I see her hit that moonsault or go for the moonsault, because she rarely hits it, it looks picture perfect in flight, but then she either over-rotates or she glances her opponent or she lands practically on her feet when she's not supposed to. It just never looks quite right to me. Becky hit her with her knees on the landing. Becky goes up top for a leg drop. She goes up top for a guillotine leg drop. She misses. Becky, at this point, getting very frustrated. Cannot put Charlotte away. So much so that she decides to powder out of the ring. She grabs her belt. She's going to leave. Charlotte speared her into the barricade to stop her from leaving and threw her back inside. She hit the second spear of the match. Well, third, I guess, if you count that little tackle I just mentioned on the outside as a spear. I guess it was more of a tackle and not so much a spear. But instead of going for the cover, after this spear in the ring, she locks in the figure four. And as she goes to transition into the figure eight, Becky reaches behind her where the belt is laying on the mat and just begins whacking Charlotte with the championship for the disqualification. So Charlotte wins the match, not the title, because this feud is, you know, this feud is going at least until Evolution. The Evolution pay-per-view is on October 28th. Probably longer even than that. I know they have their little Starrcade house show set up for late November, and they're having a cage match on that show, so who knows how long this feud's going to go on for. But as Becky was leaving, Charlotte attacked her in the aisle, because she's a sour sport, and Becky gave her an exploder suplex on the floor, a running knee to the face. Charlotte was sitting up against the barricade, so she got kneed in the face. Lame finish, but, you know, they needed to find a way to try to get heat on Becky and keep the feud going. People do not want to boo this woman. You can go and flee the country if you want to. You can flee the U.S. and you can go to Canada. You can go to Australia. You can go anywhere you want. People do not want to boo this woman. They will not boo her, no matter what you do, no matter what you try. But they're still booking her like a heel. You know, she's making all the mean faces. She's grabbing her title like a sore sport and trying to run away. I mean, that's the formula. They don't know anything else but their basic formula on how to do these things. So she's the bad guy now, but, you know, I guess she's going to cheat to keep her title, but we're going to keep cheering for her. I don't really see that changing anytime soon. Match itself, I thought, was okay up until the finish, which was lame. They have since announced a rematch for SmackDown this Tuesday. It will be Charlotte and Becky once again for the championship, and I'm sure this one will also have no decisive finish, because I don't see this wrapping up. I mean, the earliest I would see them wrapping this feud up would be Evolution, and I'm sure that will end up being some sort of gimmick match, some kind of stipulation. So we'll see. We'll see what happens on Tuesday. They have to find a way to get to Evolution. We have John Cena and Bobby Lashley against Kevin Owens and Elias. Shawn Michaels' hair fled and went to John Cena's head. This is as long as I've seen Cena's hair, even from when he used to have a little bit more hair on his head back in the day. I've not seen him with this much hair on his head, so it's a little disconcerting. I don't know, it's a little weird seeing him like that. But he's been living in China now the last few months. I think 3-4 months now he's been living in China. He's filming a movie, something I think with Jackie Chan. So I guess no Google for John Cena. I think pretty sure Google is still banned over there. This was every house show tag team match that you have ever seen in your entire life. If you think of this show as a glorified house show, this was the quintessential house show tag team match. No Leo Rush in Lashley's corner. Lashley dominated the first half of the match all by himself. Finally, the heels took control. They built to the hot tag to John Cena. He came in. He hit the running shoulder tackles. Five-knuckle shuffle. Attitude adjustment to Elias, and then he busted out what Michael Cole called his sixth move of doom. And so clearly they are self-aware. And Cena's sixth move of doom, and I know he debuted this a while back. There might have actually been, was it in Japan? They had some kind of a live event, maybe like a month ago. And it was the same exact match, I think. It was Cena and Lashley against Owens and Elias, I think. And Cena had debuted his sixth move of doom, and he used it again here, and it is a literal punch to the face. They built it up, all tongue-in-cheek on commentary, like he was debuting some sort of new twisting corkscrew moonsault 620 plancha, and then he delivered a punch to the jaw, and he pinned Elias for the win. Cena grabbed the mic after the match, did his usual, "I'm happy to be here, thank you so much for allowing me to perform in front of you" speech. The only thing missing was him saying, "Good night, get home safe." That's only because they didn't go on last. Nothing wrong with it. It's all, you know, nice for Cena to thank the fans and everything, and who knows when we'll see him again. I suspect not for a few more months. But again, there was absolutely nothing of any note to speak of here, other than it was John Cena's first match in a few months, and he debuted here on pay-per-view a punch as his new finishing move. Well, look, you know, the guy's 40 years old. He's getting up there. His body's all beat up. And so you gotta take it easy. There's no easier move to hit than a punch. The guy's looking at the long term here, right? He's playing the long game. John Cena wants to be able to come out here when he's 60 and do this. And he's not going to be able to do that by doing flippy moves or running dives out of the ring. You know, John Cena is one of the few people on this roster, even when he was full-time, who never did dives. I cannot remember John Cena. I'm sure it must have happened at some point, like a big pay-per-view spot. I cannot remember John Cena ever doing a dive, like Roman Reigns. We'll see him bust out that top rope dive every now and then. Undertaker used to do it all the time. He teased it tonight. Well, this morning. I'm all fucked up. My timing is all fucked up. I think it's morning, right? Here it's morning. There it's night. So yeah, no, John Cena is, he's dumbing down his moveset, which I didn't think was possible, but there you go. Asuka and Naomi against the hometown girls, the Iconics, Peyton Royce and Billie Kay. Let me just say this, if I may. It makes me absolutely sick to my stomach to see Asuka out there dancing when she should be killing. And, I mean, you know, I just watched this, and I know her and Naomi, I used to joke that, you know, where are they? They're missing. We haven't seen them. They're not on television. They must be in catering together. Apparently they were. And so they decided, well, we don't know what to do with these two women because we have our main feud for the championship and it's not their turn yet. And so we don't have anything better for them to do. So I know, let's put the two of them together as a tag team. And I swear to God, you know, if this company had Bruiser Brody, if the Bruiser Brody of the late 80s were alive today, first of all, he would be disgusted by what he sees here with this product. But if Bruiser Brody was around today and they had their hands on him, they would put him in a suit and they would make him a fucking stockbroker. So they have Asuka out here dancing and shooking and jiving and doing all these different things. And it just makes me sick to my stomach. The Iconics came out, they got a nice ovation, but not much after that. At least that's how it came off watching on TV. Not as big of a reaction once they got to the ring as I expected them to get. I mean, they are heels, I guess, but they worked over Asuka first for a little bit until she tagged in Naomi. Naomi was about to hit some sort of springboard move from the apron when Billie Kay yanked her off the apron and she hit the apron face first. Peyton sent Asuka into the barricade that took care of her. They got Naomi into the ring. Billy held up Naomi for Peyton to do a running knee to the side of the head, and they got the win. And this was an absolutely nothing match. This match was a nothing burger. Now, my hope going into this was that the only reason they paired Asuka and Naomi up, other than they have no idea what to do with either one of them, and with Naomi, look, you know, Naomi's talented. I'm not trying to shit on Naomi at all, but I just, what they're doing with Asuka, like Naomi's whole gimmick is I glow and I dance. And that's what she does. Her entrance, she comes out, she's glowing, she's dancing, fine. Asuka, though, is this really the best that they could come up with for Asuka? Asuka makes friends with Naomi. She wants to fit in. A few weeks ago, they're mocking her accent. She doesn't know English. You know, all these things they're doing with Asuka, and it just infuriates me. It absolutely infuriates me. And my only hope going into this was that the real reason they paired these two up was to give Peyton Royce and Billie Kay a team to beat in Australia. At least Asuka didn't get pinned. That's the best thing I could say about this. The right person got pinned in this match. I hope that's the only reason for the formation of this team. And now that Super Showdown has come and gone, and the Iconics got a hometown win here in Australia, and being that it was Naomi who took the losing fall, I can only hope that on Tuesday, Asuka does the dance of death on her corpse on television on Tuesday. AJ Styles and Samoa Joe for the WWE Championship. No disqualification, no count out. There must be a winner. The WWE title is basically, you know, we call this a glorified house show. It's basically a glorified mid-card title now at this point. Even on a show with no universal title match, they slot the WWE Championship in the middle of the card. Which was inevitable, because we all knew Undertaker and Triple H was the real main event on this show, but still, it saddens me. And this is not just a one-time thing. This has been going on really consistently since AJ Styles won the championship. To see the you know, what really is supposed to be the crown jewel, no pun intended, of the company pushed down the card like this is pretty shitty, in my opinion. I did like how they started this. AJ paused when he came out. He paused at the head of the entranceway, took the title off, just threw it down on the ground, and just stared down Samoa Joe from one end of the aisle to the other. Joe was on the other end outside the ring, just pacing back and forth. And then AJ runs down the long aisle, and they just start going at it. And I like that. I like that way of opening the match. At least they didn't open this grudge match with a collar and elbow tie-up. We've seen that before. It's always very silly. I hate your guts. You stalked my family. I'm going to kill you. But first, let me show you this sweet arm drag. We didn't get any of that shit here in this match. They went at it right away. This was supposed to be a fight. That's how it began. The crowd then went mild for a good part of this. I thought the match itself was very good. I thought this was probably the first or second best match on the show, because I enjoyed the six-man that came after this. So this was one of the best things on the entire show. It just felt like it was missing something. And maybe it was the crowd. I think it was probably the crowd response to what was going on that took me out of it. You know, I don't know. I feel like the same thing, though, happened with AJ's matches last year with Kevin Owens. The same thing happened with his matches earlier this year with Shinsuke Nakamura. And here again with Samoa Joe. I don't know what it is. I don't know how to account for the crowd being so quiet for, you know, the large duration of these matches. And typically they pick up towards the end. Maybe that's just the way that AJ structures his matches now, the way they sort of, you know, they build. They start slow and they build. But it would have been nice for the crowd to be a little more amped up for what they were seeing here, because this feud on television has been booked. I think for the most part, I've liked the way they've handled that, with Joe making it personal. He's going after the family. He's just gone psychotic. Because he legitimately got screwed out of the championship in their last match. So I'm a fan of the feud. But again, I think the crowd maybe just took me out of it. Joe grabbed the chair midway through, which was legal. But AJ kicked it right back in his face. AJ then beat Joe down with the chair, opened it, put it down, and he went for a corner splash. Now the chair is sitting in the ring. AJ goes for a corner splash. Joe catches him for that Uranage slam, or I guess the sit down, I think he calls it, right onto the open chair. So that was pretty brutal. Joe grabbed a table from underneath the ring, which got the biggest reaction of anything this entire match. I'm pretty sure up to this point in the show, that table got the biggest reaction of anything on the show. Now, the good thing about the table is that, unlike, you know, Undertaker and Shawn Michaels and Triple H and all the old guys, the table never ages. Like, at some point, Undertaker will simply not be able to wrestle anymore. Triple H will not be able to wrestle. Shawn Michaels will not be able to wrestle. It is inevitable. I mean, at this rate, I think it may be another 25 years before they retire. But at some point, everybody gets old, they age out, and you can't rely on them anymore. You know, for a company that relies very heavily on the legends to come out and save them, at some point, you just get too old, right? And you can't do it. The table, though, the table never ages. It's the legend that the company can always rely on for a big reaction whenever they need it. They should have the Dudleys induct the table into the Hall of Fame one day. It gets more chance and a bigger reaction than most of this roster does. So Joe set it up in the ring. AJ ended up, or the table, that is. But it was AJ who ended up putting Joe through the table with a powerbomb. Upon impact, Joe immediately grabbed his knee. And he told the referee, "Oh, it popped, it popped." Not the crowd, that is, his knee. Styles saw this, immediately targets the knee. At this point, though, I knew exactly what they were doing. I could see the finish in my head. They were giving Joe an excuse to lose. That's exactly what they were doing. Styles hit a 450 springboard splash onto the leg. Later on, he went for the phenomenal forearm. He had hit the forearm on the outside moments earlier, but this time, back in the ring, Joe turned it into a choke. AJ fought out of it, got Joe in the calf crusher, and Samoa Joe tapped out in agony. As I said in the predictions that I did last week, I didn't think Joe was getting the title here. And I'm not convinced that he's getting it at all, but if they were going to switch the title, I thought it was way more likely to happen at SmackDown 1000 than it was here, especially if they're going to be looking for a special moment on that 1000th show. I mean, beyond the, you know, Evolution reunion and what that may or may not lead to, I can't think of a bigger moment than having a WWE title change on that show. And I'm not saying it will happen, but of these two shows, I always thought it was way more likely to happen there. It's only 2 weeks away than it would, you know, on this show. But again, I thought this turned into a very good match that was hurt by just an overall lack of energy. You know, for what was supposed to be going in this big grudge match for the championship. That part of it was disappointing. The action, though, was very good. AJ also was bleeding from the mouth for a good part of the match. So, yeah, this was up there as one of the best things on the show. Ronda Rousey and the Bella Twins against the Riot Squad. Liv Morgan back in action and, I guess, not pressing charges against Brie Bella for her violent assault. Right away, before the match even begins, we see Nikki Bella and Ronda Rousey playfully arguing about which one of them was going to start the match. Nikki wanted to start, and Ronda said, no, I'll start, because she's the champ. So they went back and forth, right? Foreshadowing. The Bellas proceeded to wrestle 95% of this match. We did get Brie and Liv Morgan in the ring together. Nobody was killed or maimed, so that's good. Rousey finally gets the hot tag, runs wild with a bunch of judo throws. She and Sarah Logan had Sarah Logan primed for an armbar. Liv Morgan breaks it up. Rousey then looks at the two of them. She puts them both down, and she says, okay, I'm going to give both of you arm bars. And she proceeds to apply a double arm bar, one arm bar for Liv, another arm bar for Sarah Logan. They both furiously tap out. And so the Bellas and Ronda Rousey are successful. The Bellas celebrate with Rousey in a very disingenuous way. I was watching Nikki the whole time. And you could just see where this is going. Now, I suspect that Tuesday, they've already announced that Ronda will defend the championship against an opponent to be determined at Evolution. So it's been officially announced she is going to defend the championship. I suspect that on Tuesday we'll get whatever the spark is going to be for a match. Now, maybe they do like a little, I don't know why I keep saying Tuesday, because the Bellas are on both freaking shows. It has me all confused. On Monday, I suspect that we'll get the spark for a match between Nikki and Ronda at Evolution. And then look, it could just be Nikki challenging her. It could be Nikki wins some sort of match to determine the number one contender. It could be a turn. I think a turn is a lot less likely, in part because, you know, with all their reality show garbage, I just don't see them turning the Bellas, like blatantly turning them heel. So it probably will be a friendly challenge or Nikki, you know, winning some sort of number one contenders match. But I'm pretty sure, I mean, the rumors have been going around for weeks now. It looks pretty much like a lock that that's going to be the championship match at Evolution. So, Cedric Alexander and Melbourne's own Buddy Murphy for the Cruiserweight Championship. Again, I would have opened the show with this, but crowd loved Buddy. Lots of Buddy chants, big reaction. He came off like a total superstar here. Michael Cole reminded us on commentary that Cedric Alexander coming into this match had not been pinned all year. He was unbeaten all year. Won the Cruiserweight title at WrestleMania from Mustafa Ali, and he has been a dominant force on 205 Live ever since. So they protected him. They protected him very well up to this point. And as soon as the bell rang, as soon as the match began, we had an explosive knee from Buddy Murphy right out of the gate. So wicked that I think some people, myself included, bought that might just be the end of the match. It wasn't. It was a near fall. He followed that up with this gigantic dive out of the ring. He almost overshot Cedric Alexander, and it looked like he may have twisted his leg, but he was okay. He was all, I mean, this guy, you got it. Look, if you're Buddy Murphy, right, you're back in your hometown, you're in front of 70,000 people, probably the biggest crowd you've ever performed in front of. You're wrestling for the championship. You know going in that you're going to win the championship. This guy was just a ball of fire. He came out. He was all pent up. He couldn't wait to just unleash it. And so he's just a house of fire here at the beginning of the match. Slows down a little bit. Alexander hit a Michinoku driver to Buddy Murphy from the top rope for a near fall. We had a standing Spanish fly later on by Cedric for another near fall. Murphy kicked out of the lumbar check. I haven't watched every episode of 205 Live. I can't definitively sit here and say that nobody has kicked out of the lumbar check before, but I haven't seen it. So people were shocked and people, you know, he was getting a standing ovation and people were really getting into it now at this point. Murphy hits Murphy's Law, which is his finish. It's the pump handle into what I believe is called a whale hunt. Although I don't think they refer to that move as, you know, in that way on WWE television, but that's what it is. So he hits Murphy's Law and he wins the Cruiserweight Championship. This was a great match, a short match, as most of these were, except the main event. We'll get to that in a second. But this only went about 10 minutes, but it was 10 minutes of almost all nonstop action. This was, up to this point, the best thing on the entire show. I enjoyed this more than AJ and Joe, honestly. And the right man won. So everything about this, this match would have been marred, I think, if Cedric would have won. This just felt to me going in, as Cedric has been champion for a very long time. He's been undefeated all year. He's been heavily protected. The year is almost over now. This is the right time, and it's the right place to do this title change. And having 70,000 people there made it feel like a really big deal. This felt like a turning point in the career of Buddy Murphy. I look at, you know, Buddy Murphy, I look even Cedric, and I look at Mustafa Ali. I look at those three, especially Mustafa Ali, though, and Buddy Murphy, as two guys who right now they're killing it in the cruiserweight division. That's cool. But at some point in the not-too-distant future, they need to break free from 205 Live and get their asses on Raw and SmackDown. These two guys should be mixing it up with Seth Rollins and Drew McIntyre and Dolph Ziggler. Those are the guys that they should be competing with, because these guys are that good, and I think at some point they could be major players on the main roster. But the longer I feel... And look, Buddy Murphy now is champion, so he's not going anywhere. And I think that's fine. Let him dominate the division for a while, like Neville did, right? Neville's another one. And I'll talk about Neville on the podcast tomorrow, but Neville, it was a great thing for him when that heel turn happened, and they basically handed him the cruiserweight division and said, here, this is yours now. And he took it and he ran with it. But you just get to a point, and I don't know if this is why he walked out of the company or if there was something else that he was unhappy with, whatever it was, you just get to a point where you have to feel stifled. And you look at a guy with so much talent. Yeah, he's small, but so what? When you have the kind of talent that somebody like that has, you've got to, you know, you can't keep them in a little box away from everybody else. That's the only thing I worry about when it comes to, you know, a Buddy Murphy or a Mustafa Ali. So he had his moment here. He's going to be the linchpin, I guess, for a while of that division. But looking ahead to 2019, I hope they see that this guy is capable of a lot more than that, and they get him the hell away from that slowly, and they, you know, transition him into either SmackDown or Raw, because I think that, you know, he could be a money player for them at some point. So that's my spiel on Buddy Murphy here. I'm happy for him. Great match, big moment. We had the Shield against Braun Strowman, Dolph Ziggler, and Drew McIntyre. Shield made their entrance through the crowd, old school. They had the black face masks, a la WrestleMania 30, only these didn't have skulls on them, I guess because Triple H had a skull on his. He was going to be doing that later in the show. Can't have two people doing the same thing, even though we see dives and the same moves in every single friggin' match. We can have roll-ups, right, every week on television. We could have, you know, distraction roll-ups, and we can have dives every 5 seconds, but God forbid we should have, you know, two different people wearing skull masks. I thought this was a great match, even better than the Cruiserweight title match. I still have a soft spot for these Shield six-man tags, so I admit I have a little bit of a blind spot, you know, when it comes to this, but I don't know. It's hard to imagine these three, when they have these six-man tags, having a bad match. It's not quite, you know, the same as it was in 2013 and 2014 when they were doing it, but I thought that they all worked well together. It was a wild brawl right from the outset. Key came later on when Roman Reigns got tagged in. He inadvertently hit Dean Ambrose. He was on the apron, Ambrose was, and he got hit accidentally by a Superman punch that had been intended, I believe, for Drew McIntyre. And so fast forward a little bit later on, we have Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins in the ring, and they are surrounded We have Drew McIntyre. He's slowly crawling up on the apron on one side. Dolph Ziggler's on another end of the ring. He's crawling up onto the apron. And there's Dean and Braun Strowman as well. And there's Dean Ambrose. So now all four sides of the ring have people on the apron. And we don't know. Is Dean Ambrose going to side with the heels? Is he going to attack his brothers? What's going to happen here? So they really played it up like he just didn't know which side he was going to choose. Ultimately, he did side with the Shield. He attacked Braun Strowman. There's another big brawl that breaks out. Outside the ring, Ambrose is up against the barricade. Braun Strowman is sizing him up for a giant tackle of doom. He builds up a whole head of steam. He comes charging into Dean Ambrose. And at the very last second, off camera from out of nowhere, Roman Reigns flies into view. He saves Dean Ambrose. He takes a bullet for his brother. He spears Braun Strowman through the barricade, and they're both wiped out. Ziggler and McIntyre, they quickly throw Ambrose back into the ring. They're going to go for the Claymore zigzag combo. Rollins super kicks McIntyre out of the ring. Ziggler connects with a kick to Seth, turns around, dirty deeds, 1-2-3. Just like that, the Shield picks up the win. I thought this was a great finish to overall what was a great match. Now, I still would have had Braun Strowman pin Roman Reigns to give him a, you know, let him pin the champion heading into the triple threat match at Crown Jewel. But they have a month before that show. They can still do something along those lines between now and then. That didn't have to be on this show, I guess. But I have very few complaints about this match. I thought this was, in terms of actual matches, for me, this was probably the best on the show. I know some people might say AJ and Joe. For me, I would go Shield six-man number one, Cruiserweight number two, AJ Joe number three. I mean, that was just the order in which I enjoyed those matches. One match I did not enjoy, Daniel Bryan against The Miz for the right to challenge for the WWE Championship. Miz immediately goes after Bryan's ribs that were injured on SmackDown. Bryan does the S-kicks. He misses the running knee. Instead, Miz hits a knee of his own for a near fall. Miz goes for the skull-crushing finale, and Bryan cradles him for the shock pin. I just told you the entire match. 2-minute match. Daniel Bryan wins with a roll-up. Now, nobody was expecting that to be the finish, so the reaction from people in the first few rows was exactly what you would expect it to be. It wasn't quite Brock Lesnar breaking the streak at WrestleMania 30 or anything like that, but people were shocked. This sucked. And for an 8-year-long feud, if this really is how they end it, I just don't know what to say. I don't know what to say to that. You know, I did not need to see these two guys this late in the show go 15 minutes or anything like that. But still, 2-minute match. Bryan wins with a roll-up. Fuck you. This sucked. Now, that being said, we are now getting Daniel Bryan against AJ Styles for the WWE title at Crown Jewel in Saudi Arabia next month. I think that should be excellent. I would not count out Samoa Joe just yet. For everybody blasting WWE, or that will be, I'm sure, blasting WWE, or saying, oh, it's too bad, you know, Joe had a lot of momentum, it's too bad they didn't go with him. I would not count out Samoa Joe just yet. I still think there is a chance, maybe not a big one, but I think there is a chance that he wins the championship at SmackDown 1000. Now, if they do set up a match with him and AJ at SmackDown 1000, that's it. It's do or die. If he doesn't win it there, he ain't winning that title ever. That's it. And it may already be it. This may have been the last hurrah for Joe because he tapped out. There was no ambiguity this time about the finish. There was no, you know, referee missed something and he got screwed. No, he tapped out. Now, he had the built-in excuse of the knee injury, so at least they tried to protect him a little bit, but it's hard to come back from that. But if there's one last opportunity to do it, it's 2 weeks. SmackDown 1000, that's it. That's their last shot. They could have a WWE Championship match one final time, you know, and have it on that show. I would not rule out Joe just yet, because if Joe were to win the championship on that show, obviously, AJ would be entitled to a rematch. Bryan is now entitled to a championship match. It could very easily turn into a triple threat at Crown Jewel. It could be Daniel Bryan, Samoa Joe, and AJ Styles with Joe defending. It could happen. We already have one triple threat match for the championship with the Universal title on the line on that show. Would it be all that, you know, unorthodox to think that they might have two on the same show? What's good for one is good for the other. So let's just wait a couple weeks and see what happens. I would not count out Samoa Joe's chances of being champion just yet. Then we had the main event. Triple H against The Undertaker. Last time ever, but not really. I've been saying that for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I meant every word of it. And I guarantee you it is not the last time we are going to see these two in the ring. Of course, what was so funny to me is if you think back to Raw last Monday, Shawn Michaels came out. And at some point during his promo, he specifically mentioned, I believe he said, one-on-one for the last time. So we're already qualifying it. It only took a few weeks for them to now qualify it. Instead of saying last time ever, oh wait, it's last time ever in a one-on-one match. I love that. I love it. Shawn Michaels, ringside in the corner of Triple H. Mayor Kane in the corner of his brother, The Undertaker. Very start of the match, JoJo makes the announcement that this is a no disqualification match, which is something that this match sorely needed. You know, at this point, let me just say this before I get into the specifics of this match. I enjoyed this. I enjoyed this for what it was. Again, maybe that's just me having a soft spot when it comes to seeing some of the, you know, some of the legends. And, you know, we've seen some Undertaker matches in recent years where he really didn't look that great. And, you know, they weren't terribly long matches. He was gassed, or he just looked like he was moving like he was a crippled zombie or something. And, I mean, he still kind of moves like he's a crippled zombie. Then again, it is his gimmick, right? He is the Undertaker. But I enjoyed this for what it was. Now, let me just get that out of the way first. The fact, though, is that these guys need to, at this point, rely on smoke and mirrors, and that's completely understandable. Without them, without the no DQ stip, without being able to use a table and a chair and all kinds of weapons and a sledgehammer, okay? Without all that and without interference from people like Shawn Michaels and Kane, who are also old, this would have been unbelievably dull. And I know a lot of you are probably listening going, well, how does that differ from what the match actually turned out to be? The match, even with all of that stuff, was incredibly dull. True. There were a lot of very slow parts of this match, but they took more abuse than I thought they would. Honestly, they did more in this match than I expected that for a glorified house show. They did more than I expected them to. Triple H took a lot of abuse. Undertaker took a lot of abuse here in this match. They weren't all bloodied up or anything like that. Triple H in particular, I mean, his back was all marked up and he took some body drops on the concrete and stuff. And look, I respect the effort. And they told a story here in this match. The story going in was that this was their final fight, even though I cannot believe it. And it's a complete insult to the audience. They were talking on commentary openly about their WrestleMania 28 match. They made reference to the end of an era match. Renee Young said, oh, I was just a fan at that time. I remember that match. And I'm sitting there, do you realize the irony? I'm just thinking to myself, do these people not get the irony of billing this match last time ever? And yet on commentary, you're telling us about the last time they had a match, how it was the end of an era. What the fuck does that even mean? We never really knew. We never found out. We just sort of assumed, well, that means it's probably Undertaker's last match, or that means that, you know, we're not going to see the Attitude Era guys anymore, or that that was going to be the last match ever between Triple H and The Undertaker, none of which turned out to be true. But yeah, they're talking, oh, remember that end of an era match? I sure do. I sure do. But I will say this, this match did not need to go nearly 30 minutes. On a show that was littered with matches that went 10 minutes, 12 minutes, 8 minutes, they went over 27 minutes from bell to bell in this match. Almost half an hour. I couldn't believe that. When it was over, I just, you know, and I saw the actual time of the match. I mean, it felt like a 20-minute match, but this was almost 30. And I said, did this match really need to go 27 minutes? Absolutely not. And it might have actually been a better match had they shaved about 8 or 10 minutes off. There was a spot here where they brawled out into the crowd. So they took the action into the crowd, this just sea of humanity. And they go over to one of these technical equipment areas or whatever. And Undertaker grabs a cable. I don't know if it was a camera cable or just a cable that was hooked up to some piece of equipment somewhere. And he wrapped it around Triple H's throat. And my first thought was, uh-oh, that's a no-no. And you could tell Triple H almost immediately, he just ripped that thing off his neck. And they tried to move on. I wouldn't even put it past him if they edited that out of the replay, honestly. Undertaker is probably the one guy who would not get in trouble for doing that. But that is a big no-no. That is a big no. Daniel Bryan got fired for choking a guy with a tie on television, okay? That just, it just, they don't accept stuff like that anymore. So that was kind of surprising to see. But then again, if you think of their WrestleMania 27 match, there was some controversy even then. There was a chair shot to the head, even though Undertaker got his hand up at the last minute. It was hard to tell. And people were wondering, oh, is he going to be fined for that? You know, it's hard because you got a guy like Undertaker who for so many years, you know, he wasn't constrained by all of these rules. You can't do this. You can't choke anymore. You can't do that. And sometimes you sort of fall back on those old habits. But when I saw that, I just thought immediately to myself, uh-oh, Triple H could not get that thing off his neck fast enough. There was a different point in the match where Undertaker teased a running dive. Remember the old running dive that Undertaker used to do at WrestleMania? Almost killed himself at WrestleMania 25. Couldn't help himself. He still did it at WrestleMania 26. He did it at WrestleMania 27. And the only reason that he stopped doing the dives was because at WrestleMania 28, they were enclosed inside the cell. And there was no room for him to dive. I wonder if they made that a Hell in a Cell match to protect this guy. To protect him from himself. And obviously his body has broken down even more since then. But for a moment there, I thought, well, this guy, I think he had some kind of hip operation earlier in the year, or maybe late last year. He is moving around better than he was probably a year ago. And I thought, oh God, Triple H is outside. Shawn Michaels is outside. They're sort of huddled together in a way that you would expect they're going to catch somebody. And I bought into it for about 2 seconds there. He went to go hit the ropes, and I literally, like out loud, it must have been, 8:30 in the morning here, and I'm just, or maybe it was later than that, but I'm just sitting here going, you better fucking not. Don't fucking do it. And thankfully, they cut him off, and he didn't do it. I was genuinely concerned at that point. And I hate when I watch matches, and all I can really do, like in this case, these guys obviously are a lot older, I hate when I just sit here, and instead of kind of allowing myself to enjoy it, I'm more concerned, like, please don't die, you know? And so in that moment, that's what I was thinking. But again, all the plunder came out. There were chair shots and there were tables, and Shawn Michaels was being a pest outside the ring, and Kane would chase after him and Michaels would run away. And there was a table that was set up outside the ring. And Shawn Michaels super kicked Kane. And Kane just very gently fell backwards onto the table. And Triple H climbed up onto the apron. He did a diving elbow off the apron. Thankfully, the table did break. So that took Kane out of the equation here in this match for a while. Back in the ring, Undertaker hits a tombstone piledriver to Triple H. Triple H kicked out. And the Undertaker looks up at the referee, Mike Chioda. And Mike's like, two count only, got the shoulder up. And Undertaker, he's getting back to his feet, and he punches Mike Chioda in the face, knocks him out. Well, that was uncalled for. So now the referee is out because Undertaker is just being a total dick, and he's hitting Triple H with chair shots, and he puts the chair around Triple H's throat. Now Undertaker keeps looking at Shawn Michaels on the outside and pointing at him, and he's talking trash. I like that. I don't know, he was acting in a way that you would not expect the Undertaker to act. He was acting like a real arrogant prick here in this match. And Shawn Michaels is begging him, don't do it, don't do it. And he's like, I hope you're watching, you better watch. So he's just taunting Shawn Michaels on the outside. And Shawn gets up on the apron, he tries to get in the ring, Undertaker knocks him down. Triple H comes back, hits a pedigree, Undertaker kicks out. So Triple H takes the chair. And he puts the chair around the Undertaker's throat, like the Undertaker had done to him earlier, right? Turnabout is fair play. Second rope, Triple H comes off, stomps the chair. Undertaker got this weird, I can't even describe how he sold this. I was laughing at the way that he sold this. Triple H went for a cover. Kane drags the second referee out of the ring. So now that referee, he lands awkwardly, and now he's hurt. And so now we have two referees down and out. We have no ref. Shawn Michaels finds the sledgehammer, pulls it out from under the ring. He gives the sledgehammer to Triple H. Kane, now, you got to picture this, right? Triple H is slumped down in one corner. Undertaker is slumped down on the opposite side of the ring in the other corner. Shawn Michaels hands the sledgehammer to Triple H, and on the other side, Kane hands a steel chair to the Undertaker. So we're about to have a chair versus sledgehammer duel. Now, this kind of reminds me of rock, paper, scissors, right? Scissors will always lose to rock. Paper will always beat rock. Scissors will always beat paper. We know these things. These are just common basic facts of life. And one other basic fact of life that Undertaker should have been well aware of is that in the battle of the sledgehammer against the chair, the sledgehammer will always win out. And sure enough, he swings the sledgehammer into the chair, hits Undertaker. Triple H wins that battle. There's no referee. So Triple H goes to use the sledgehammer again. This time, though, Undertaker traps him in Hell's Gate. Still no referee. He's got him in Hell's Gate. Triple H has possession of the sledgehammer. And now he's choking out the Undertaker with it. Undertaker is just moaning. And now both guys are out. Undertaker's out. Triple H is out. People are chanting, "This is awesome." Again, because the match itself was not awesome. But people were sort of, I think, just wrapped up in the moment. And they respected the effort that these two guys were putting in. And so out of respect, they chanted, "This is awesome." Okay? So, again, I can understand that. I kind of fall in the same camp here. Not that I thought the match was awesome, because it wasn't. But these guys were beating the holy hell out of each other. And, you know, they were having a war in the middle of the ring. Shawn Michaels gets possession of the sledgehammer. He goes to use it on the Undertaker. Kane is back in the ring now, and he saves the day, and Undertaker dumps Shawn Michaels out to the arena floor. Undertaker decides, you know what, I'm not going to use the sledgehammer. I could use it, but I'm not going to. He ditches it. And he goes to hit Shawn Michaels with a tombstone. Triple H, though, hits Undertaker with the sledgehammer. Shawn Michaels super kicks the Undertaker. And Undertaker then stumbles into a pedigree and is pinned. To me, the outcome here, it was not a surprise at all. In fact, I would be very surprised if people did pick Undertaker to win going into this show. I don't know why you would. If you had any knowledge of the rumors that, you know, they're going to do a tag team match in Saudi Arabia, which they are, that became very apparent here at the very end of this show, then it made absolute sense to think that Triple H was going to win. Or if nothing else, that there would be a non-decision, right? Because it wasn't, well, I guess they made it no DQ, so at that point they kind of handicapped themselves. So yeah, at that point, to me, it was just obvious that Triple H was going to win this match because he needed the win a hell of a lot more for credibility to build to a tag team match. I mean, if Undertaker just beat him clean with a tombstone or tapped him out to Hell's Gate, how is that any different than all of the matches at WrestleMania that the two of them had and all the matches at WrestleMania that The Undertaker had with Shawn Michaels? If the same person wins over and over and over and over again, after a while, you know what I mean? It just, why would anybody be interested in seeing that? It's like one of the things I never really understood about why Hulk Hogan always had to win against Ric Flair. Now they're best of friends. Hulk and Rick, they're tight. They're thick as thieves now. But when they were working together in WCW, you know, like when Hogan first came in, he beat Flair for the championship, right? That was a big match, Bash at the Beach, 94. Fine. Hogan came in, made a big splash, won the title. And I feel like every time, and I'm sure Flair had some wins in there, but just thinking off the top of my head, all the television matches they had, all the pay-per-view matches they had, Age in a Cage, everything else, Hogan always won. He just, like, Flair could not buy a win over this guy. And it just, to me, I don't understand if that's insecurity on Hogan's part. I don't know if that's just him playing politics. I don't know if that's just what Eric Bischoff wanted, because Eric Bischoff, after a while, didn't like Ric Flair. I don't know exactly what it was. But to me, it was never really interesting, because the outcome of those matches was never in doubt. So when you have two big names like this, you've got to throw the other guy a bone every now and then. It's not like there's a streak anymore. This is not WrestleMania. So naturally, Triple H picks up the win, and they're going to build to something else. If you didn't believe it before, you can believe it now. They all come together, all four guys, show of respect. They're shaking hands. They're hugging. There's a big pyro celebration. They're all holding each other's arms up in the air. I wasn't buying it for a second. I'm watching Undertaker the whole time. I'm waiting for the choke slam or waiting for the tombstone to come. Because, you know, I've been hearing the same rumors that all of you have been hearing about Crown Jewel. And I'm thinking, well, this would be a pretty anticlimactic way for the show to end. Triple H beats The Undertaker and they just go off the air with Undertaker endorsing Triple H and pointing at him. And, like, it can't end like this. And sure enough, it did not. Undertaker looked at Kane and Kane looked at The Undertaker. I think Kane punched Shawn Michaels in the face. Undertaker picked up Triple H, hit him with a tombstone. I did pop for that. They took Shawn Michaels, whose hat went flying. I have to say that the hero of this show, and the one that put in the greatest effort, was Shawn Michaels' hat. It stayed on his head for a very long time until it just could not stay on his head any longer, and it went flying off. And he's got that, it's not a bandana, I don't know, it's like a headband, it's a headband. He's got the headband around his head. I don't know why he bothers wearing the headband. You know, he legitimately looks like one of the wet bandits from Home Alone. I mean, he just needs to ditch the headband and embrace the baldness. So they take Shawn Michaels outside the ring, and they're clearing off the announce desk. And the Kane picks up Shawn Michaels. They pick him up for a choke slam. They put him through the table. Thankfully, it broke. So now Shawn is wiped out. And the announcers are saying, oh, this is a betrayal. This is a betrayal. As though the four of them were just bosom buddies or something, like Dean Ambrose is turning on the Shield. Apparently, it's a big betrayal. These guys that have been feuding for years and for weeks now, we've seen them on television talking about respect and insulting one another and deeply personal, like grave insults. And they're talking about this like it's some sort of big betrayal. So I couldn't really buy into that. I just looked at it as Undertaker was frustrated as fuck that he was shown up by Triple H. This is not the way that he envisioned this ending, and so he decided to take it out on them. He decided to take it out on these two cocky, arrogant assholes that he's been feuding with for years and years. And, you know, and that's exactly what you would expect them to do. So the Brothers of Destruction walk out together. And I actually thought that was a pretty cool way for the show to end. Hell of a lot better than just going off the air with them holding each other's hands up in the air. And they look badass, Undertaker and Kane did, walk into the back. And so now we're going to get a tag team match in Saudi Arabia, November 2nd, Crown Jewel. The announcement, I'm sure, could come as early as this week. This is not the end of this. We're going to see Shawn Michaels and Triple H. Shawn Michaels back out of retirement for the first time in, what, 8 years, I guess? 8.5 years? Taking on Undertaker and Kane. And I think it's going to be the same exact thing that we had here. I don't expect that it's going to be a great match. I expect that it's going to be, you know, it'll be cool to see the four of them in the ring. Here's the problem with that, though. We basically got the tag team match tonight. Did we not? Or this morning. There I go again. We basically got the match here on the show. Shawn Michaels is bumping around like crazy. Kane gets put through a table. They're interfering every 5 seconds. I mean, we basically got Crown Jewel a month early. Shawn Michaels came out of retirement here on the show. So now they'll make it official, I guess. It'll be an official tag team match. I don't know that that match can be better than what we got here. I think they gave us the best that they could possibly give us. Again, with all the different spots and the abuse that they took and the table spots and the chair spots. You know, what more could these two, what more could these four guys do? Are they going to have a classic wrestling match? No. I mean, even with Shawn Michaels in there, you still got the other three. You know, are they going to wrap themselves in barbed wire? I hope not. I don't know what we're going to get in Saudi Arabia that we didn't get here on this show, in all honesty. When this was over, even though I enjoyed it for what it was, and yes, it was slow and it was plotting and it was sad in a lot of different parts. Although I will say Undertaker looked better than he's looked at other points in the past. When this was over and they went off the air, I was left even more bummed that Shawn Michaels is going to waste a perfectly good retirement to come back for a Saudi payday. And I imagine that he'll wrestle more than just the one match at Saudi Arabia. There's talk of him and Undertaker at Survivor Series, maybe. And it's hard to think that if Shawn comes back now, he's not going to have a WrestleMania match. So look, Shawn Michaels may end up having a whole bunch of really great matches. You know, just because Undertaker and Triple H were plodding along, Shawn Michaels was taking all the bumps. You know, he was bouncing around like a rubber ball out there. I don't doubt that he could still go out there and do it. It's going to be hard for me to watch a Shawn Michaels match with no hair. But, and it's not just the hair thing, but just, I felt like, do we really need him to come back and spoil what had been, in a lot of ways, I think, the perfect retirement, the perfect storybook ending to one of the great careers of all time? He's going to make that bank. I don't fault him for it. I don't blame him for it. I probably would do the same exact thing if they flashed millions of dollars in my face or whatever it is that they're offering him. So I get it, and I'm going to try to enjoy it, and I hope he goes out there and doesn't look too far off the way we remember him. But there's still a big part of me that's just very sad that he's coming back for this. So that's your Super Showdown review. Again, I think the best way to describe it is if you paid $20 to go to a local house show that comes to town and you have 10,000 people there, you have certain expectations about what that show is going to be. It's going to be very basic in a lot of ways. You'll get a couple of good matches. Basically, this was that show, only in front of 70,000 instead of 10. That's what this show was. And you had a special main event. They tried to make that thing as special as they possibly could. And again, I can't shit all over it. There was something about it that I just enjoyed it. I did enjoy it. It was slow and plodding in a lot of different parts, and it was sad, honestly, to watch at other points. But I want to make one point here, and then we'll wrap this up. And it struck me as I was watching the end of the show when they were all holding each other's arms up in the air. And look, the people still eat it up. When Undertaker makes an appearance, it's a big deal. It feels special. When they see Shawn Michaels, right? I mean, it's the law of diminishing returns. You have these guys every week on television. They're not going to feel as special. I think Brock Lesnar understood that. But I watched this and I thought to myself, back to the comments that Kevin Nash made. And I'm going to get into this on the podcast tomorrow, so I don't want to get too far into it here. But he had made comments recently to the effect of, nobody's over. All the young guys, all the current talent on the roster, nobody's over. It's all about the old guard and the old guys, and none of these guys can, you know, are like that. And he blamed it a lot on like high spots and flippy moves and stuff. And he was way off in that respect. He's not wrong, but as far as the reason, he was way off. And I watched this and I thought to myself, you want to see one of the many reasons, besides the booking, you want to look at one of the many reasons why nobody is over like these guys. First of all, those guys have 20, 30 years of experience in television time. So yeah, they've got a leg up on the current talent for that reason. But why is it that there's such a reliance on the old guard? I'm fine with having a special attraction match, but when you build around it as your main event, this was, make no mistake, going into the show and then in execution, this was the main event of this show. Here in 2018, Undertaker versus Triple H is the headline attraction here on this show. They're going to go to Saudi Arabia. I don't know what's going to end the show. I imagine it'll be the Universal Championship Triple Threat. But apparently the Saudi prince there or whatever, the boy wonder, all he wants is all the old guys. Last time he wanted Yokozuna and the Ultimate Warrior, and I could just picture all the WWE people like putting him on hold being like, who wants to be the one to tell him, you know? And so they'd bring all the old names back because that's what people want to see. There's rumors Hulk Hogan might come back on the Saudi Arabia show, which would be rich. You know, Hulk Hogan, the real American, makes his big comeback in Saudi Arabia. I would laugh my ass off, but there's a problem here, and the problem is that if you are a Kofi Kingston, if you are a Cesaro, if you are an AJ Styles, if you are anybody from the current crop of talent on that roster, and you look at this, and you're sitting in the back, what are you thinking? I genuinely would love to know what they're thinking, and I would not publicly expect them to tell the truth, but you have to believe that there are at least some, if not a lot of those guys sitting in the back who either didn't even wrestle on the show, or if they did, they were way, way earlier in the night, and they're watching on a monitor, and they're thinking to themselves, that should be me out there. why are those guys still out there in the main event while I'm sitting back here on my ass? I'm in my prime years right now. These guys are 49, 52, 53. They move around, some of them, like they're 65. Why are they out there in the main event and I'm sitting on my ass back here? Why is the WWE Championship mired in the middle of the show, a show where there is no other world championship match and the Universal title wasn't even defended? Why is that title in the mid-card and Undertaker and Triple H are hitting each other with sledgehammers and chairs here in the main event in 2018? And so I look at this and I say, boy, you know, I think back to the Attitude Era and 1998. Can you imagine in 1998 if Bruno Sammartino and Bob Backlund and Billy Graham were called upon to wrestle in the main event of SummerSlam and WrestleMania? Can you imagine how ridiculous that is? And do you think that guys like The Rock and Stone Cold and Triple H would have gotten over the way they did? No, because they had this new young crop of talent. They put the focus on them. The product was hot. They let those guys run and they just got over like gangbusters and everybody made money. And it was the hottest period that I can ever remember in the history of that company, maybe in the history of wrestling. When those two companies were neck and neck fighting it out every week at their peak, and it was only about a 2-year period, 3 years, but everybody was making money and everything was hot. Now, WCW was a different story because WCW really did rely a little too much, which is part of the reason why they're no longer alive, on the old guard. WWE had no choice but to make new stars and get them over and book them in a way where they wouldn't be buried, and they flourished. But here we are, and it's been 20 years, 25 years, almost 30 years for some of these guys. They've had long careers. They were the top stars back during that period, Undertaker even before that. And here we are in 2018, and they're still relying on these same guys to basically carry the mothership for them. I mean, they're doing what they feel they have to do. But ask yourself, why do we not have guys that are even close to the same level as these guys? It can't just be that, oh, they've been around for so long. There's got to be more to it than that. There is not a single person elsewhere except Brock Lesnar on that roster who feels even remotely as special as the guys that were in this main event. As Shawn Michaels, as The Undertaker, as Triple H. They feel like stars on a whole other level. And there are guys that have been in this company for many, many years. And I'm not going to use Kofi, because Kofi, you know, Kofi's a tag team guy, but Kofi's been around a long time. Dolph's been around a long time. There are guys that are still young, somewhat young, who have been around a while. Why are they not looked at in a way that feels even remotely special compared to these guys? Why is there still this reliance on the old guard when they should be creating a new guard? And they could be the ones, 10 years from now, being called on to have a match at a special show. No, you know what's going to happen in 10 years? It's going to be The Undertaker against somebody else. It's like time stood still in this company. They hit this wall, this force field they can't break through, and we're living in a time warp. And if you're a company trying to create new stars while you're still relying on the old guard to get you out of a jam. Oh, we got a bad rating. Let's put this guy on TV. Oh, we got a big show coming up. Let's have The Undertaker in the main event against this guy. Or Shawn Michaels go up against that guy. There's a place for those guys. But when they're in the main event and you're building everything around them, if you're on the main roster, what is going through your head? Ask yourself that question. And when you hear people like Kevin Nash talk about, well, nobody's over, ask yourself why. And I will point you to this. Maybe not Exhibit A, but if it ain't Exhibit A, it's Exhibit B, C, or D. Of the many reasons that we could talk, I could go on for hours about why that is, but I will point to you this as an example, and this does not help. It might help in the short term, it will not help this company in the long term, and they have to do something about that, because one of the reasons why people are fleeing is not just because the shows are fucking boring, it's because there's nobody around anymore who really feels like a star. And maybe that's just the whole brand thing. It's about the brand. It's not about the stars. Well, maybe it should be. Because I watched that scene at the end here, and I thought to myself, boy, this company doesn't realize it, or maybe they do. They got problems. They got big problems when it comes to creating new stars on this level. If they're going to keep relying on these guys, give it a few more years. Maybe not even that long. They're going to be in for a rude awakening. Let's wrap up with your mailbag questions. You can always email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. And we're going to start out here with DJ from Bob Cajun, Ontario. I always love hearing from people from new places I've not heard of before. I looked it up. Population, 3,500. So thank you to DJ for writing in. As WWE transitioned from one era to another throughout history, have they historically been known to bring back old-timers? When the era shifted to Attitude, I certainly don't remember Vince bringing back Hulk Hogan and Bret Hart to headline shows over guys like The Rock, Stone Cold, and The Undertaker. Is this reliance on older stars a one-time thing, or is it a sign of creative failure? Well, I mean, Vince couldn't bring back Hogan and Bret even if he wanted to. Not in 98. So that might be not the best example to use, but I get your point. It's what I talked about. I don't want to rehash this all over again, but what I just got done talking about. I assume part of it is that as they do big shows like this in foreign markets, they feel the need to load them up with stars. And because nobody feels like a real star anymore, it becomes even more important for them to just throw a pile of money at guys like Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker to get them to wrestle in places like Australia and like Saudi Arabia. Undertaker this year alone, between that first Saudi show against Rusev and the Australian show against Triple H and then the Crown Jewel show coming up where I'm sure he's going to wrestle, and this is not even counting his WrestleMania match with John Cena. He's wrestled more matches this year than he probably has the previous 2 years combined. But I do think a big part of it is creative failure. It's not just that they're being brought in to headline these shows, the last few weeks of television, the key segments all involve the people I just mentioned. And just everything else on the show just feels inconsequential. You know, Seth Rollins, I don't know that there was anybody except maybe Strowman. They were neck and neck. But they had something in Seth Rollins over the summer that I haven't seen them have in another talent in a very long time. The guy was on fire when he had the Intercontinental Championship. I mean, he has it now, but then he lost it. Before he lost it, though, he was defending the title. He was having great matches, but it was just, he would come out and get these superstar-like reactions that had me and other people thinking and hoping that if it wasn't the plan, maybe it would be the plan for him to go up against Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam and not Roman Reigns. And of course, they just stuck to their guns and they went with Roman and they had a pretty disappointing match and Roman won the championship and nothing has really changed except that they reunited the Shield. And they reunited the Shield to build a Shield around Roman Reigns, and basically because Seth and Dean both, who came back recently, were so popular, don't think for a second that one of the biggest reasons they reformed the Shield wasn't just to make up for that, you know, terrible, cursed attempt at a reunion last year that just didn't work out. It was because they were hoping that that would rub off on Roman Reigns. Now, it might have worked a little bit. It hasn't worked where he's coming out and getting cheered every week. I don't think that's ever going to happen. But I look back and I say, man, they really had something in Seth Rollins, and then they just went with their tried and true, this is our guy, instead. And then they reformed the Shield, where it almost just feels like, well, now Seth is not his own, he's not his own man anymore. Now he's just sort of, you know, he's one of three, and, I mean, I like the Shield, don't get me wrong, but they really had something with Rollins, and I think the timing was terrible for them to abandon that and to not go all the way with it. Maybe had they done that, Rollins truly would have had that special feeling about him that he doesn't have. So, anyway. Matt from Bakersfield, California. What has been your match of the year so far? Mine is very recent. It is Jay Lethal versus Will Ospreay from the ROH World Title match at Death Before Dishonor. What is yours? Mine is still Johnny Gargano against Andrade Cien Almas at TakeOver Philadelphia way back in January for the NXT Championship. That is still my number one match of the year. After that, it would probably be the match that Kota Ibushi had with Ishii in the G1 climax. I mean, there were so many unbelievable matches in the G1 this year. That's one of the ones that stands out to me. is Ibushi and Ishii, but my top one is still the TakeOver match. Steve from Green Bay, Wisconsin, here's a thought. What if WWE Network subscribers could vote in a poll before each pay-per-view for which advertised match they would like to see as the main event? And the winning match goes on last. Could an idea like this work for WWE, or is it a bad idea? Getting the fans involved and making it interactive on some level is not a bad idea. But I think after the first time you do it, you know, you'd probably end up with a bunch of people just trolling them with their choices in those polls, and they'd have to stop. You know, sometimes the choice of which match goes on last depends on what the finish is, and if they have some kind of big angle, some kind of big wrestler return that's planned, and they want to save it for the very end of the show. So you wouldn't be able to do it for every show, maybe every few months. That I think could work, but not every month. Plus, it's not like WWE actually cares what people think when it comes to these polls. They put a poll up on WWE.com 3 months out from WrestleMania 33, asking us, who do we want to see the most in the WrestleMania main event? This is last year. And AJ Styles, I think, before they took it down, AJ Styles had something like 40 or 50% of the vote. And Roman Reigns, I mean, The Undertaker was at like 10%. Roman Reigns was at 5%, I think. And they yanked the poll down. And they just did what they wanted to do anyway. I mean, not that the .com polls are binding, and they just base their creative decisions on exactly what the poll results say. But why even ask that question in the first place? It was such an embarrassment. And then when they got the answer they didn't want and they were embarrassed, they pulled the poll. So that just tells you what they think about what you and I think. David from Sacramento, with Sasha Banks, I should say, out with an injury, how would you feel if she returned as a heel with Bianca Belair as her muscle in a sort of HBK Diesel pairing? Especially if there is going to be a women's tag team division. Now, we don't know yet the nature of her injury. Sasha is hurt. I don't know the extent. I don't know what injury it is. She's been dealing with that. So, look, she may only be out for a week. She may be back wrestling tomorrow night. Or she may be forced to miss the Evolution pay-per-view. We just don't know. I would like to see, you know, me personally, I would like to see Bianca Belair dominate the women's division first in NXT. But I don't hate your idea. In fact, I like your idea a lot. You know, she and Sasha are very similar in terms of their on-screen characters. One calls herself the boss. The other one calls herself the EST. Right? I'm the greatest. I'm the best. Whatever other words you can think of that end with EST. I think that could work not only as a pairing where the two of them are together, but also when the inevitable split happens, the story sells itself. Bianca Belair gets... She gets over so much, she overshadows Sasha. Sasha gets jealous. And then the two of them can feud. But I think as a vehicle to rehab Sasha and to get Bianca Belair over, because I think what would happen is that people would start cheering for her more than they would Sasha, I think that could work. I think that pairing really could work. My problem is I just have so little faith in the main roster at this point, or the way they you know, use the main roster. They've shown zero interest this entire year in doing much of anything with Sasha Banks. I would hate for Bianca Belair, who's got a lot of potential. She is maybe the most impressive person to me in NXT right now, certainly top three. I would hate for her to make her debut on the main roster, and then 2 weeks later, she's sitting in the back and catering with Sasha. While we get a match on TV between, you know, Nia Jax and Brie Bella. And mother of God, that sounds like a horrible match. May it not ever happen. But I don't want to see that. So that would be the only thing holding me back. But I like the pairing. Brandon in New Jersey, who do you think is John Cena's greatest rival? I answered this question once a long time ago and I said the fans. And I was only half joking when I said it. But if we're talking about actual talent, I would say CM Punk. Some people might say Edge. Some people might say Randy Orton. You know, the way that Michael Cole in WWE used to talk about it on commentary, just because they had so many matches together, you would think that Cena and Orton was the second coming of Austin and Rock, which is laughable. CM Punk is John Cena's greatest rival, and it still bugs me that the two of them never had a WrestleMania main event together. It should have been WrestleMania 29. That really should have been the main event of WrestleMania that year. Instead, they got the belt off Punk 2 months before just so they could do the rematch. The rematch of a match they claimed going in was once in a lifetime. Does that remind you of anything coming off this the build for this Triple H Undertaker last time ever match? You notice, by the way, how last... I can't let this go. Last Monday on TV, I didn't talk about this, but Shawn Michaels came out to do a promo, and he mentioned in promoting this match, he talked about last time ever, one-on-one. Did you notice that? Now they have to qualify it, because they know how full of shit they are when they say that. Last time ever, not counting tag matches, or triple threats, or fatal four-ways, or arm wrestling matches. Anyway, but here they had to book the rematch, Rock versus Cena. They had to do it again, and that second match sucked. I hated that second match. At least live watching it, I don't even know if I've ever gone back to watch the televised version of that match with commentary. I just know that I just did not like that match. Like, live in the stadium, I mean, the only thing missing was a pillow. I hated that match. It should have been Punk and Cena, with Cena ending Punk's long reign as champion. You know, that pile driver spot they did on Raw the month before WrestleMania when Punk and Cena had that great match, that should have been saved for the WrestleMania main event. You would have had 75,000 people lose their minds for that spot. It would have been great. Daniel from Memphis, Tennessee. What was the deal with the Dustin Rhodes shoot promo in WCW as the character Seven? Was it a worked shoot? And what was the original idea of the Seven character? So this is a kind of a loaded question here. So the Seven character was based off of a movie that came out in the late 90s called Dark City. It had Kiefer Sutherland and Jennifer Connelly, and it might have had a couple of other names in it. But it was called Dark City, and if you remember, I saw that movie a long time ago. Clearly the look of the Seven character was based off of, you know, there were characters in this movie that looked very similar. So they had these grand ideas for it, and they had weeks and weeks of vignettes that were building to the debut of this mysterious new character. We didn't know who it was or what it was. And then finally on Nitro, Seven made his debut, and it was this elaborate entrance. They had smoke, it was dark, it was very Undertaker-esque. He floated to the ring. He didn't walk to the ring. In midair, he floated to the ring. And as the story goes, standards and practices over at Turner, they basically put the kibosh on the character, or at least there were issues involving the character. Maybe they wanted it to go in a different direction than what was originally planned, because there was the feeling that if you look them up, the old vignettes building to the character, they show a young child in his bedroom, and there's this really creepy voice. We can hear the voice, we don't know who it's coming from, and the voice says, you know, come to your window, and the kid goes up to the window. And there's Goldust, but he's dressed up as this Seven character. He's like all white. He's got a black hat on. He puts his hand up against the window to touch the kid's hand. And then I think when the kid turns around, like, his eyeballs are all black. It was creepy. But I guess they thought that the character was coming off a little too creepy because of those vignettes. Like, he came off as somebody that was, like, kidnapping little kids. And so they had months of vignettes like this. And my timeline could be off here. I want to say, at least the version of events that I am aware of, it may have been an idea or a character that was conceived of while Eric Bischoff was still in power. I don't want to say it was Bischoff's idea. It could have been somebody else's idea. But I think Bischoff was in power. Bischoff either left or got fired. Russo came in. And then it was a few weeks later, I think, that Seven made his debut on television. And it may have just been that Russo decided to cut bait on the character or just take the character in a totally different direction. The direction that you would expect a Vince Russo character to take, which is that Seven came down to the ring after this elaborate entrance. And the very first words out of his mouth, cut the music. And then he went into his promo. It was supposed to be a shoot, where you thought that he's coming out and shooting on this terrible character. Look at what they're making me do. I was Goldust in WWF, and Goldust sucked, which Goldust did not suck. And one of the all-time great quotes, if you go back and watch the 7 debut promo on Nitro back in 99, in the middle of the promo, not at the very beginning or anything, he's in the middle of shooting, quote-unquote, and he's in the middle of his rant, and he just goes, "Oh, and my new name is 7, by the way." Like, he was supposed to mention that first and forgot, and then he's like, "Oh, yeah, my name is 7, just in case you're interested in knowing. That's my new name now." And he just completely shot all over the character, and "I came here to get away from the gimmicks in WWF, and this is what they have me do, and they just fired my dad, Dusty Rhodes," which I think was a shoot. I think Dusty had just been fired like a week or two before. "This is, you know, they disrespect my family, now you gotta deal with me." So it was very Russo-esque in what was going on here. And it was believable. I mean, if you go back and watch it now, you kind of see it for what it is. Look, if it was a real shoot, he wouldn't be... There's certain comments that you make in the context of a wrestling promo that should have been a giveaway, that it wasn't like a real shoot. But they wanted people to think that it was. And they just abandoned the character before they even gave it a chance to work. I don't know if it would have worked or not. Probably not. It probably would have been one and done. But they never gave it a chance. Literally, from the night it debuted, they shit all over their own character. That's how ridiculous this company was from late 99 onward. And the changes in power, and people coming and going, and it was just craziness. I think Dustin stuck around for a while. He was calling himself the American Nightmare, which is what Cody calls himself now. Instead of the American Dream, he was the American Nightmare. He didn't last very long. He was gone, I think, a few months later. But yeah, that was the whole story behind the 7 character. It was supposed to be this mythical, creepy thing. And there was a fear within the executive ranks there that he was coming off like, I don't know if he's coming off like a pedo or he was coming off just like somebody who was going to snatch your kid from their bedrooms, which is probably not such a great idea for a wrestling gimmick. And then they just abandoned the whole thing and sent him out there to shit all over it. And it was an embarrassment, as many things were back then in WCW. John from California, what are your thoughts on Andrew Lincoln leaving The Walking Dead? Well, it's disappointing. He is the heart and soul of that show. And now you're going to take him away from the show because he's had enough and he wants to leave. And that's his right. And I don't know how many people are going to stick with this show once he leaves. He's like probably the one character where, you know, once he is either killed or he just leaves, I don't think they're going to kill him. I mean, we'll see. I know The Walking Dead is back tonight. At some point this season, obviously, they'll write his character off. My gut tells me he won't be killed off. That way they leave it open in case he wants to come back or make cameos. But who knows? So it sucks. And we'll see as the season progresses if I stick with it or not. I've stuck with it this long. I don't know if I will continue to do so or not. One thing I was really bummed to hear before I started recording, I saw there was a news breaking news online that that guy Scott Wilson, the actor who played Herschel on The Walking Dead, died. I think he was said something about cancer. He was in his 70s. So yeah, he just passed away either yesterday or this morning. He died, so that was really disappointing to hear. But yeah, Walking Dead back tonight, and I'll be checking it out. But I don't know, season 9 could turn out to be my last, depending on how the season goes. I have not been overly excited by what's been going on. I've been into Fear the Walking Dead, and now they've brought one of the characters from The Walking Dead over to the other version of The Walking Dead, and it really has turned into his show. So, you know, the Morgan character, if you don't like the Morgan character, you probably fucking hate Fear the Walking Dead. You're probably thinking, why have they infected this other show with this character I don't like? I find Morgan to be very annoying, or I did, on The Walking Dead. Just what they did with him and how he would behave and act, and he was kind of acting all crazy. And so I've warmed to him a little bit. I've been enjoying Fear the Walking Dead probably more than the main Walking Dead show. I don't know. We'll see what season 9 has in store. I've been finding other shows, like the Channel Zero show. Other creepy horror shows to get into. Dan from Niagara Falls, New York, and we'll end with this. Let me take you back to the late 80s, he says. Michael Keaton, starred in two of his most iconic roles in back-to-back years. Both films were directed by Tim Burton, but he played on opposite sides in each film. Buy or sell on which role you believe Michael Keaton turned out the better performance and which side he was better suited for, Beetlejuice or Batman? Oh, that's a good one. That is a good one. I'm going to buy on Michael Keaton as Batman, and I'm going to sell on him as Beetlejuice, and I love both movies, so I loved him in both. But Michael Keaton, to me, is the best person to play Batman of all of the people who have played Batman. So whether it's Adam West on the old TV show, whether it's Christian Bale, whether it's Val Kilmer, George Clooney, what's his name? Ben Affleck, right? Wasn't he Batman, I think, in one of the new movies I didn't see? So in fairness, I didn't see him play it, but I'm willing to bet dollars to donuts that he wasn't as good as Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton, to me, is the best Batman that there has ever been. But I say that even though I feel like The Dark Knight is the best Batman film. That's my favorite Batman film. In fact, The Dark Knight is one of my favorite films of all time. I love that movie so much. But the original from 1989, the Burton one, is pretty close. There's so many things I love about that first Batman movie, the Burton one. I think it has the best bat suit of all the films. I can never understand why they could never get it right in any of the other movies. They would upgrade it. They would try to make it look, you know, bigger and different. And the one from the original in 89 was the best one. The best Batmobile. The Batmobile looks cool in the first one, not so much in the other movies. You know, but the Dark Knight film, the second film that Nolan did, to me, it's so epic. Just the way it was filmed, the music, the interrogation scene, Ledger as the Joker, you know, taking nothing away from Jack Nicholson, who also was, I thought, a fantastic Joker, but Ledger was just, I mean, it was, you know what, though? It's two totally different Joker characters, if you watch them, the way they're portrayed. The Ledger one, a lot darker, more serious and sinister, and I don't know, human on some level. You can't go wrong with either one, but I just put his, you know, the Ledger one, just in a whole other category by itself. So even though the first one, the Burton movie, got so many of those other elements I just mentioned right, where the other movies failed, The Dark Knight, to me, is still my favorite of all the Batman films. So let's wrap it up here. You can keep emailing me questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. If you haven't already subbed to our YouTube channel, we are now over 40,000 subscribers. The Solomonster is my username on YouTube. You can find the official Sound Off channel. Hit the sub button there. I am going to be attending the Hall of Fame induction next Saturday. It's going to be taking place at a bar and grill in New York. Hall of Fame induction, the Impact Hall of Fame, that is, for Abyss. So I will be there. I bought my ticket. I'll be there as a fan. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's a very worthy addition to the Impact Wrestling Hall of Fame. And I will be at Bound for Glory next weekend. Bound for Glory is taking place in New York as well. At the, I believe it's the Melrose Ballroom. I should know this, but the Melrose Ballroom. MLW has been taping a lot of their TV shows from there recently. It's in Long Island City. So it's going to be an Impact weekend for me next weekend. And I'm sure I will talk all about it on the show. Although Bound for Glory is going to be after I record the Sound Off. So anyway, that should be fun. And don't forget, I'm going to be putting the event invite up on our Facebook page and the fan page. I'll share links to it elsewhere for our Halloween weekend meetup, October 27th, at Beer House NYC. Please, if you think you might be able to join, RSVP. And costumes are optional. They're not required, but they are encouraged. It is, after all, a Halloween meetup. So feel free to dress up as whoever you feel like dressing up as. And that's about it. I got nothing else. I will see you guys back here for episode 568 next weekend. Until then, be well. Stay safe. Thank you for all the birthday wishes and all of the support. I have the best fans in the world. And I will see you back here next weekend for more Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
I'm just saying, I don't know, with New Day, you got three black guys out there. Why Francesca?
You want to call it Tyrone the Trombone?
Okay. That's racist.
Well, no, it's...
Racist, no.
I'm not racist. Go to Hulk Hogan for that. That's not me.
You know, usually the people that go, I'm not racist, those are the racists.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.